and welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. So much to get to, so much going on. They're going to start off, you know, over the weekend, the Pennsylvania GOP had their little foray there in Hershey through their support behind Corbett. Although unanimous, very small numbers, kind of a tacit response, interesting, going to be very, very interesting to see how the big money in the state backs the Corbett Cawley train. Eye of the Tiger, man, they came marching into Eye of the Tiger! Yeah, I'm going to talk about that. Also, education leads to higher wages. Isn't that what they tell us? Get better education, you're going to make more money, right? Meritocracy, they kept telling us that. Oh, well, facts really not supporting that assumption anymore. And some troubling things going on, as the more educated seem to be, well, making less money than my grandparents, than my grandfather did with an eighth grade education. Also, being poor can be extraordinarily costly, we all know that, and can be deadly. We'll talk about that. And also maybe focus on a little bit of what real paycheck protection looks like. I know we've been hearing a lot about how the GOP here in Pennsylvania really wants to protect those state workers' paychecks. Oh, they care! Lots of language. Oh, we're going to protect their paychecks by making sure that they don't have the ability to bargain, by making sure that they don't have a voice in what happens. That's the goal. Understand, that's the end game. If they can make collective bargaining illegal like they've tried to do in other states, what better protection for your paycheck, right? Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me during the program, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So it was an interesting weekend. Got to get right past the big news, couple of big things over the weekend. Actor Philip Seymour Hoffman found dead, age 46, a heroin overdose, evidently. And, you know, I guess you could go into a whole bunch of why, oh, what, so young. You know, as one person wrote on my Facebook page, you know, hey, I'm 46, and wow, you know, that could have been me. I'm 46 too, but I'm afraid of needles. The heroin helped. And look, I don't know what demons he had. I don't know what he saw, what his world was. I'm not going to judge. It's a sad thing when anyone loses their life early or in this fashion. Brings me back to the idea that maybe we look at drug abuse, maybe we look at addiction in this country a little bit differently as an illness, not as something to be punished. Maybe we look at it in a different light, and maybe the death of someone like this actor who, you know, was a fantastic actor. He was what he was. But at the end of it, you know, there are thousands of people every day battling the same demons, battling the same addiction that nobody knows their names. No, the paper doesn't pick up on it. The media culture doesn't stop. I heard radio stations from here to New York where, you know, they're playing canned music. You know, all of their Sunday programming is all pre-recorded, where they actually had somebody phone in. Hey, you know, we're going to talk about this on Monday. Don't forget to tune in, because, hey, don't forget, we've got this tragedy to exploit. Sad. And it's a loss for three young children who will never know their father. But, you know, beyond that, again, like I said, thousands of people. And my thoughts, my heart, my want for them goes out. Not just Philip Seymour Hoffman, but all of those folks who are struggling, which tells me that we should be doing more to make sure that all folks battling these demons, battling these addictions, have an opportunity to get some help before this happens. Because understand, you do heroin long enough, here you are. This is reality. It is what it is. You do hardcore drugs, it is what happens. You know, it's just the nature of the beast. And I had someone tell me today, well, you know, he was such a genius because of the heroin, and it was the drugs that made him open his mind. I'm going, well, I guess someone could make that argument. I never will. Again, I don't know the demons. I don't know how his mind worked. I don't know how he dealt with stress or pain or any of that stuff. my feelings are for his family and for those families across this country who are in the same kind of situation. Also on Sunday, everyone knows the big game. I'm not allowed to say the S. I guess I could say Super Bowl. It's over now. But the big game in New York. I do my Sunday job where I every Sunday I drive into New York and back just to keep my CDL up, and because I like driving a truck. I like the therapy of driving. I like the mental solace. I like the time to think and just to concentrate on that. So it's kind of, for me, it's like therapy. But, you know, I got into New York, got right out. No lane closures. Very happy about that. They left the New Jersey Turnpike along George Washington Bridge. No lane closures, thanks to Chris Christie. And I said this before, it's not going to go away. It's not going to go away. But if Christie was saying what he was saying, if that was true, he would be okay. Evidently not so much. And there's some real interesting stories going on here where you've got this David Wildstein, who's saying he's got information that Christie knew all about it. You've got the woman, this Bridget Kelly, who's saying that I'm pleading the fifth. I'm not doing any of this. And you had another guy, that Bill Stepien, who also said pleading the fifth, not going to incriminate myself, not going to jail for him. It's going to be interesting. I mean, this is going to be one of those things where you go, wow, Chris, you got yourself in a ringer. So it's going to be interesting to see where this goes in the next couple of days with all the different agencies investigating this. Also the New Jersey legislature having some hearings, some subpoenas. Should be, you know, very interesting next couple of months. I do think that this could end up biting Christie in the behind, and that's the end of his political, his presidential aspirations. Because at the end of it, there were Republicans sitting in that traffic as well. And, you know, anyway, let's get to the other piece. Yeah. As a Broncos fan, as someone who has followed the Broncos since I was 10 years old, they got thumped, man. They just, the most thorough destruction of any team, I think, in Super Bowl history. I don't spend much time on this program talking about sports, but since people know I'm a Broncos fan, I just got inundated with email and messages and people throwing verbal jabs at me. And look, it is what it is. I mean, the reality is it was at no point during the game were the Broncos even really participants. I don't even think they had a chance during the coin toss. I mean, that's how bad it was. When in 2 seconds into the game, you're down 2-0. Trouble. And I think that's going to be a record that will stand for forever. There are very few records you say that's going to stand forever. I think that one may. The opening snap of the game going through the back of the end zone and there being a score with that little time, I think that one will stand. Now, you know, as somebody who has followed the Broncos for years, you know, I've been here before. I got beat, you know, back in the 80s. I think it was 45-10 by Washington and 55-10 by San Francisco. So this was, you know, right there. But this one was different. This one, they were nowhere near at any point. The other two, they were up 10-0 at one point and then just got shellacked. This one, it was never even, there's nothing. In fact, I fell asleep about halfway through and my wife didn't bother to wake me. So that kind of tells you how things went. Now you go, well, at least the commercials were good, right? No, the commercials were horrible. I mean, the commercials were almost as bad as the game, right? Does anybody remember any of the commercials? I remember Bob Dylan was one of the, in one, I don't remember what he was there for. I just remember, I remember that, but I don't remember why. So if anybody remembers why, I would love to hear it because I don't really remember. They tried a lot of sentimental stuff kind of thing. But you know, the car ads were at best boring. I mean, you go back to the Clint Eastwood one, at least that, you know, that's Clint Eastwood. You're going to remember that, right? But you know, now I look at the big one and you knew what was coming out of it. When Coke did the America the Beautiful thing, and I had heard about this before the game even started. I had heard that, you know, their Coke was going to have this America the Beautiful ad and blah, 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 all this stuff. And I remember as it was playing, turning to my wife going, wow, boycotts are coming. The ire of the radical right is coming. And it didn't take long. From what I understand, Twitter exploded with it, Facebook everywhere. Before halftime, my wife got a boycott Coke thing from her brother. Evidently someone had started it, and they were just passing it around like wildfire. Because heaven forbid we talk about this nation as a multicultural, multinational country. That, like, there was anyone here before we got here, and they spoke anything other than English. And it's really just amazing to me that we have, even in this day, that we're just that narrow-minded. So I'm also curious what you thought of the ad. Was the Coke ad good, bad? Are you boycotting Coke? I personally went out and bought, I don't drink Coke, I drink Pepsi usually. I went out and bought a Coke today, just one. And I probably won't buy another one for, who knows, another 10 years. But I did buy one just because, you almost have to, don't you? The other part of the Super Bowl coverage that I found interesting was the Barack Obama interview with Bill O'Reilly. And, it was what it was. And, the big part of it was the president saying, it's people like you who keep saying stuff that's not true. It's people like you who keep promoting things on your stations that not true. The Benghazi, the IRS, you go through all of this stuff and you go, it's been investigated thoroughly. And yet the insanity continues. If you hadn't seen the interview with Obama and O'Reilly, it's not worth the time. Save your 10 minutes. Do something else. Knit a sweater, something. Also, the post-game show had some interesting moments. One where you had a 9/11 truther grab the microphone from one of the linebackers. Part of me wanted to see the linebacker beat him with the microphone. That would have been entertaining. Not so much. The other part, the commercials had a Buy American theme, made in the U.S. kind of theme to it. Sad reality is a lot of the things that they were promoting don't necessarily know that they were made in the U.S. or entirely made in the U.S. And I understand, people want things made in the U.S. We like the rhetoric. We like it. The problem is corporate America doesn't. Our tax policies don't promote that. And, the reality is, voters in this country overwhelmingly support job creation over the Tea Party. We need debt reduction. I mean, we know that. We know that the priority should be to rebuild American manufacturing. And we saw a couple of commercials that talked about that. We're so far behind. We've lost so many millions of jobs over the last 20 years, especially since NAFTA. It's going to take a lot of policy. And that policy has to be trade deals and tax code and all of those things and tariffs again. But, I guess the biggest obstacle, if we're going to reinvent manufacturing, us. We got to demand it. When we go to the Wally World or the Target or we go to any of these places to do our purchasing, we got to say we want it made in the U.S. To me, that simple. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We're in the process of making the demand and making it a strong demand on staples that they put postal employees, APW-represented postal employees, in these retail units.
American Postal Workers Union President Mark Demenstein In a deal with the U.S. Postal Service, Staples has opened mail service centers in some of their stores. Demenstein says that postal employees are not being used to staff them, and that could put tens of thousands of good jobs at risk. It's a post office privatization thrust, he says, that goes deeper into the retail side than ever before. And he says Staples has had to pay millions of dollars in fines for wage theft of its workers, and Staples' wages are lower, with fewer benefits than postal workers get. Demenstein says that outsourcing mail service centers to Staples will hurt the Postal Service, and in coming weeks, the American Postal Workers Union will wage a strong campaign to stop postal work being outsourced to Staples.
Staples is one of these classic corporate companies that has had to pay fines for wage theft of their low-wage employees. In 2010, they had to pay $42 million. They're in the process of lowering the hours of their employees to avoid any obligation under the Affordable Care Act. We think both the people of the United States are going to suffer behind this deal, and obviously a transfer of good-paying union jobs, living wage jobs, to low-wage, non-union, non-benefited, non-living wage jobs is of great concern to our union, and we think to the people of this country as well.
Nearly 1,500 United Auto Workers members from across the U.S., Canada, and Puerto Rico are in Washington, D.C. for the National Community Action Program Legislative Conference. The conference deals with UAW's legislative and political agenda for the coming year. UAW President Bob King will deliver the keynote speech. U.S. Labor Secretary Thomas Perez and House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi will participate as the union meets with members of Congress. UAW CAP delegates advocating for working families will be lobbying members of Congress during the conference. In Oregon, the Portland Association of Teachers is taking a strike vote on Wednesday. The union and the school district have a mediation session on Friday. Issues include salaries, early retirement incentives, and workload class size issues, among others. The teachers' union says it doesn't want to strike, but they're, quote, resolved to do whatever it takes to halt the continued erosion of the teaching and learning conditions in our schools, end quote. All the workers at a Snarf's sandwich shop in Chicago are being rehired and will also get a month's pay. The workers were fired 3 days before Christmas. After they got together and mounted a campaign to get their jobs back with community support, they reached a settlement with Snarf's CEO, Jim Seidel. The workers are announcing the victory at a press conference in Chicago.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I'm proposing something we haven't had in a long time, a reality-based budget.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. Yeah, the governor wants to take us back to the good old days of the 80s, where we funded higher education, back to the good old days where we, well, didn't quite. And I look at this, and you know, I look at this reality-based budget mentality that, well, you know, we're broke, we don't have money. But yet we seem to be giving a whole boatload of money to these big corporations. And in fact, the people at Good Jobs First just came out with a new study that called Putting States' Pensions Cost in Context. They come out with this study that said, look, you know, the money that we've given to these big corporations through loopholes and tax breaks and all of these different things costs 2.5 times what it is that we're investing in state worker pensions. So while we're saying, hey, we can't afford these pensions, we're handing out the money out the back door. And I looked today, I don't know if you saw it this morning, as I was on my way out the door, 81, one of the PennDOT workers, trucks flipped over on 81. Here's a guy taken to the hospital. Maybe Corbett and the rest of them, good time to steal his pension, right? These are people who risk their lives every day, spend hours away from their families every day. And the thanks we're giving them, going after their pensions, doesn't make a lot of sense to me, which is why I have asked Pennsylvania Auditor General Eugene DePasquale to come talk to us about this and, well, maybe a couple other things. Eugene, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, always a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this study, and it's, you know, for those of us who follow this stuff, it's nothing new. I mean, we're giving huge amounts of money out to these big corporations who are just playing beggar thy neighbor economic development at a time when we're underfunding everything else. We're underfunding the pension system, our education, our infrastructure, all of this stuff. It seems dumb to me.
Well, first of all, I mean, the education situation in the state is, I audit all the school districts in the state, and I am very concerned about the state of public education in Pennsylvania, whether it be, you know, whether it be a charter, a traditional public, the cyber charter, the lack of accountability that we have. dollars, not enough dollars going to the classroom. I'm very concerned about that. So you start off from that base level. If we're going to have a bright future, we have to have a quality education system. So that's issue number one there. That's critical. Anybody that wants to prosper, we've got to do a better job on education. But the issue you're raising is, beyond that, is that this sort of false choice we're being put before us on our pension system. One of the things that I think is critical is we see is the best way to actually fully fund our pensions is, A, have the state do their job and then put the money aside, which didn't happen from around 2001 to the second Rendell term. As I say, the legislature basically went on a 7 to 8 year vacation on putting money into the pension system. That certainly created part of the problem. But another part is you have a growing economy. If your economy is growing, you're going to have more money in your state coffers. That's just simple economics.
Right.
And one of the things that I have already started an audit of is the Department of Community and Economic Development. With all this money that we are spending on quote-unquote job creation programs, I think it's about time we get a baseline of what we're actually getting for this, for these investments. Are we truly creating middle-class jobs, or are we just padding somebody's wallet that may not even live in Pennsylvania? We've got to get to the bottom of this so that we can actually make, when the state budget passes, I can be helpful to the legislature, say, here's what we're actually getting for this money. And this money just being thrown out the window, you can pull those credits back, for example, and put that right into the pension system.
So you're looking into auditing the Department of Community and Economic Development. For folks who may not know, what does the Department of Community and Economic Development do? What's
their
charge?
The credits and the tax, well, the tax break, some of that flows through revenue. But most of the credits and spending that we do towards companies for job creation, that flows through the Department of Community and Economic Development. One of the things I campaign on is we need to find out exactly what we're getting for those dollars. So that audit is underway. It'll take some time, but we're going to get to the bottom of finding out exactly what we're getting for those state taxpayer investments. And again, it's important for people to realize is your state tax dollars, and sometimes it has merit, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, so it's not to say it's all bad, but your state tax dollars go directly to companies sometimes or through an economic development agency to, in a sense, create jobs. We need to find out if that's actually happening.
Well, I got to tell you, Auditor General, that's music to my ears because this is an issue that I have been screaming about for, well, almost the entire 8 years I've been on the air. This whole beggar thy neighbor economic development where we're pitting states against one another for huge checks. And I look where
Absolutely.
I live in Carlisle. Carlisle Tire and Wheel was a corporation that was in Carlisle for 93 years. And the state of Tennessee gave them a pot of money, a pot of gold, about $34 million. And the state of Pennsylvania didn't have $34 million to give. They left.
I'm glad you said it. I mean, look, and part of this is I get this from a narrow view of a governor. You know, you want to fight for your state. And I don't know how the best way to do this. So this sounds maybe more grandiose than possible, but I hope it. I think the president almost should convene a summit with these
yes.
50, with the 50 governors. And just say, guys, we got to cut this off.
I've asked numerous congresspeople who I've had on this program, why can't we use the Commerce Clause to stop this, stop governors?
That's exactly right. I mean, I sorry to interrupt, but this is – I get why an individual state governor would do this. I'm not saying it's right, but I get it. But when you're basically fleecing the American taxpayer.
Yep.
That's what's happening because you're forcing states to compete each other, and the company wins. They get a better deal, and when those credits break off, they put themselves out for the next highest bidder.
Absolutely. And I look at this. The one thing I did want to bring up is this cracker plant that the governor is going to give. I think it was $1.7 billion
right.
over the next 25 years. I mean, that's a decision that's going to affect governors well down the road and budgets well down the road. And, you know, I've talked to numerous location specialists who have said, look, they were building that plant there anyway. It was the only real place where they could because, after all, the gas is there.
None of us were in the room when those negotiations were happening, but you certainly get the sense that we weren't driving a hard bargain. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So now this is something that you're going to be looking into.
Absolutely, yes.
So when we see these huge, these big cardboard check moments where the governor's
right.
out there smiling with a business owner who's bringing jobs from Phillipsburg, New Jersey to Easton, Pennsylvania because they got a pot of gold, this is something you're going to look into.
We're not going to. We are doing it right now. We're looking into it. And it's not just looking into it in the sense of, well, did this create a job or not? We want to see where the money flew through.
Good.
And where it went to. Did it actually go and create jobs on the ground for the average working men and women of Pennsylvania? Or, you know, through some of the loopholes that we have, did any of that money even flow out of state where we didn't even get a benefit for our own tax investment? We're going to be looking at a myriad of issues, but the goal is to find out which programs work and which ones don't for actual Pennsylvania jobs.
Because, you know, I look at this stuff, and you know, personally, I think a lot of this money that we're sending to these companies, and maybe this will bear out in your investigation, maybe it won't, is going towards mechanizing, going towards making people redundant, and therefore not actually losing jobs in the process. It's good for companies. It's great for them. It's great for the bottom line. It's great for profits. Not so good for people who actually have to work for a living.
See, and that's why I've stressed to my team that I want to get at the actual job creation numbers, because I think what you're raising is, look, and some of this stuff is, look, companies are always trying to make themselves more efficient, more competitive. Okay, we get that. That doesn't mean the state should be subsidized.
Exactly.
That should be, I get that. A company is always going to try to become more competitive. And look, some of that is just inherent, and it's a challenge in our system. And that's, and sometimes it's tough to deal with. But that doesn't mean the taxpayer should, in a sense, be subsidizing their own demise.
You know, and I got to tell you, Eugene, this seems to me not to be a right-left issue. This is just a basic worker issue to me.
I will guarantee one thing. You know, look, and obviously the Tea Party has different philosophy from you and me. But one of the things they do talk about, and I give them credit for this, is the crony capitalism side of it. And the, you know, the Tea Party and the 99 movement both talked about that issue. That is it really is a deck stacked against business owners that aren't politically connected? I guess that's one of the, I think that's one of the themes that both sort of the left and right on the reform side would agree that needs to be explored.
And I think most, I don't care what side of the political divide you're on, I think everyone agrees that we shouldn't be picking winners and losers. We should be setting a ground floor with regulation and policy that everyone has to follow. And if you believe in capitalism, you believe in competition, let them fight it out on an even plane with equal rules and no tax breaks, none of that stuff. You do it.
And just to further that, what the state can do beyond that is have a quality infrastructure and a quality workforce.
There you go.
So that companies will want to expand or invest here simply because we have the infrastructure and the workforce, and we don't have to give them tax breaks to do it. People go, I'm going to Pennsylvania because they've got the best workers in the country, educated, ready to rock and roll, and they got the infrastructure so we can deliver our products where we need to, whether it be rail, road, et cetera. That is an appropriate role for me as far as the government, as far as what we should be doing make sure that we can compete for any type of job.
I agree with you. You know, and the location specialists that I talked to, they say there are five things that companies look for. The first three are location, location, location,
right,
obviously, and then education and infrastructure. And, you know, I say we've got location. The governor himself says we're within a day's drive of, 60% of the population?
Absolutely.
We've got location. Yet I look at his disinvestment in education. I look at the paltry transportation bill that even his own commission said wasn't enough. And I got to wonder, you know, in 10 years, in 15 years, what will we look back on this governor? Will this be one of those moments where you look back and go, man, we really screwed up with this guy?
Well, I would say that that there's no question in my mind. And look, hopefully we're all living on. If I'm wrong, I'll come back on the show in 50 years when you're still going strong and eat crow on it. but I will be shocked if even 10 years from now, let alone 20 and 50, we don't look back on the education budgets of the state over the last couple of years and think, what were we thinking?
Let me ask you this, you know, because there's a lot of talk about the pension situation. And I've heard I've heard a couple of different frames. One, the sky's falling. It's the end of the world. We're broke. Tomorrow, everyone retires, and we've got I think the last big number I saw was $42 billion liability. Everybody goes. The governor, Cawley, every state worker, everybody. All tomorrow, they all retire, and tomorrow it's all due. It's the end of the world.
Huh?
It's the end of the world.
Yeah, right.
And then there's the other side that there's no real problem. Everything's fine. Act 120 took care of it. Everything's fine. Where are we in that spectrum? Are we at either of the ends? Are we somewhere in the middle in your view?
I would say we are somewhere in the middle. For the sky to be falling, or that there isn't a problem, I think. But I've got to call this like I see it. I think both sides are an exaggeration on that. But let's get to how the problem was created. It, it was not created because state workers didn't do their share. They did. They took 7% out of their pay and put it into an account. That's what they were supposed to do. That's what the law said. The biggest problem of why we're in a jam, first of all, well, I guess there's two reasons. Number one is just the nature of our economy over the last 10 years, where the stock market's been up and down. Now it's back up again. But it's been seesawing back and forth. And when the economic implosion happened in 2008, that obviously was a major.
Sure, the Bush collapse had a lot to do with it.
No, there's no question about it. And the whole restructuring of our economy, which has hurt so many middle-class families, not just in Pennsylvania, but all over the country. That's number one. But number two, and even bigger than that as far as just the pure pension system, is following the 2001 pension increase, which happened for legislators and state workers and teachers. You can really make an argument that that shouldn't have happened. And once September 11th happened, it should have been pulled back.
Right.
But once it happened, the state needed to. It was critical to put money into the pension system every year. And it didn't do that up until about 2007, 2008. That really is what is the culprit for what we're facing today.
But as I remember, Eugene, they were saying at the time, the Wall Street's doing so great, everything's wonderful, we're flush with cash, we can now move on and spend it on other things. We don't, because this is all taken care of. If I remember correctly, that was the argument.
That's right. And that's why I'm so out there speaking against us going back to trying to do that same thing again. There's talk about lowering what are, quote unquote, the collars, which would be the state investment,
right,
into your pension system. Why, even for my department, that would make things much easier breathing room for me as a department for the next couple of years. I also think as the fiscal watchdog for the state, it's a very, very bad idea.
So what you're saying, let me just stop you and just clarify. So what you're saying is there's talk that this governor is not going to make the pension payments that we're supposed to be making. They're not going to uphold the state's obligation to these workers' pension like the workers have upheld their obligation this year.
There is talk of that, correct?
And they're going to spend it somewhere else.
And the idea is to use that for a short-term, quote-unquote, fix for education and some other issues because the public has no more, not that there was a desire before, but now there's literally no stomach in the legislature for any more education cuts.
Well, it is an education. It is an election year.
But that's where there is talk of that. And I will tell you that that's how we got into this problem in the first place. Again, I think for us to, you know, for anyone on the left to say there's no problem, I don't think that's, you know, that's not being intellectually honest. But on the same token, the sky isn't falling. We've got to look at how, this is what I say. You know, before you can fix the problem, you got to look at how you got into the problem.
Right.
And now we're looking, you know, potentially at somebody proposing a solution to the problem that is how we got into the problem in the first place. It doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't. And what are you expecting to hear tomorrow? I mean, I've heard a lot of things, the little bit of money into education, because like I said, it is an election year. So he's got to do that again. Are you expecting this to happen? What are you expecting out of tomorrow's budget talk?
My gut tells me that he's going to say, if we do these things, you know, and I would think, you know, name a couple of them, but I think pensions will be one of them. Then we can use that money to put into education. And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Not only does it not fix the problem, it may actually make it worse in the long run, but it creates a false choice of state workers versus education. And I just don't think that's a healthy place for our system to be with anyway. There's a whole bunch of options we should be considering before we even begin to try to pit, you know, workers against students.
You know, here's the thing that gets me, though. You know, most of the things that he's done, I should say the vast majority of things that this governor has done, has actually made things worse. And, you know, when they proposed the cuts early on in his term, you know, I said, well, you know, if it's going to make the future a little bit better, a little belt tightening, you know, because, you know, we were sold that idea. We in the working class are used to bearing the brunt of these crises where we say, you know what, we'll have, you know, the store brand this or that, or, you know, turn off the cable or whatever so we can make it through the rough time if it's going to make things better. But I'm looking 3 years into this term, 3 years of less education, of less health care, fired teachers, you know, go down the list, the general assistance budget eviscerated, health and human services gutted, all of this stuff. We're no better for it. In fact, I would argue we're probably worse off.
If we were heading into this year with growing revenues, a straight-notch fiscal ship, and now the governor's taking extra revenue and putting it into the schools, I think his political hand would be incredibly strong. Because you could say all those things that you talked about, those tough decisions I made 3 years ago that you didn't like, thought were unpopular, but now this is why I did it. You know, he would have a very convincing argument. The problem is, if we've done all those things and we're still looking at a deficit, it didn't fix the problem.
Yeah, and the sad thing is we've gone and we've given that money that we took literally from the most vulnerable and given it to the most affluent for what I'm going to argue probably not much benefit. And I would be very interested in your findings once you go after and investigate the community economic development funds.
Certainly when we're done, we'll be very public about it, but more than happy to come on the show and talk about them in more detail with you on the show.
I appreciate it, Eugene. It's always great having you on the program. Thank you for the work you do, and thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure, Rick. Take care and keep chugging away at it.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com. And click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Assume that you ran a business that was found guilty of bribery, forgery, perjury, defrauding homeowners, fleecing investors, swindling consumers, cheating credit card holders, violating U.S. trade laws, and bilking American soldiers. Can you even imagine the punishment you'd get? How about zero? No jail time, not even a fine. Plus, you get to stay on as boss. You get to keep all the loot you gain from the crime spree, and you even get a $8.5 million pay raise. Of course, you and I would never get such outrageous, absurd, kid-glove pampering by legal authorities. But then, we're not the capo of J.P. Morgan Chase, America's biggest bank and a crime syndicate that apparently is too big to jail. Jamie Dimon is the slick CEO who has fostered a culture of thievery during his years as a top executive at J.P. Morgan, leading to that shameful litany of crime. Yet, federal prosecutors have bowed to the politically connected Wall Streeter, refusing to ruffle his feathers with even a single criminal charge. Meanwhile, one of the scams that Dimon directly supervised produced a $6 billion loss for shareholders in 2012. And his reign of mismanagement and illegalities cost the bank's shareholders another $20 billion in federal fines last year, resulting in a 16% drop in profits. You might think the bank's board of directors would at least slap Jamie's wrist for the loss of those billions, but no. In January, they rewarded him, raising his pay by some 70% to a sweet $20 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, the New York Times noted that, to ordinary Americans, such a reward for a poor performance, quote, may seem curious. Curious? Try incomprehensible, insane, and immoral. Wall Street's haughty elites continue to demonstrate that they're common mobsters, only not so ethical.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
One 888-520 Rick. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. I got to tell you, I am thrilled to hear the Auditor General say that they're going to go looking into the money that we spend giving to these big corporations. I am thrilled to hear that somebody finally, and I've been calling for this for 8 years on this program, saying we have got to look at all of this beggar thy neighbor money that we're giving out. When the governor has a big press conference, oh, we brought jobs from across the river from Phillipsburg, New Jersey to Easton, Pennsylvania. But hey, we had to give them a boatload of cash to do it. When you look at Kansas City and you look at Kansas and Missouri, who they're just beating each other bloody over how much money they can give to these companies who are just moving within the same city, within Kansas City, back and forth across the border. It's insane, especially when you look at the fact that we are defunding education. $1 billion this guy took from education. Now, I know they love to say, oh, wow, you know, that's, No, I don't know. It's $1 billion. And, you know, I remember as a kid, basic simple math, you took $1 billion from the first year. Did you, was it back the second year or did it automatically go back? Did you, was that a one-time thing? No, you took $1 billion from it. So if you took $1 billion from something and if 3 years in a row it wasn't there, that's $3 billion. So that means our kids' future defunded. And I know I've heard this argument. Well, we spend a lot of money on education. And I would agree if we didn't spend so much of it on handing out to private special interests. This whole charter school thing, and Eugene was very, very middle of the road on whether it's the charter schools or the public schools or who knows what. I'm telling you, these charter schools, what they've turned into, the original concept I was in favor of, what they've turned into, what they've morphed into, I don't know how anybody can be in favor of it. Because it just means we're profitizing our kids' future. So when you're taking that money out of education, when you're taking that profit motive out of, when you're taking that profit money out of education, where is it not? It's not in the classroom. And you look at 20,000 education professionals kicked to the curb. Is it any wonder our state's economy is struggling? Now, over the weekend, the Republican State Committee held their big gathering in Hershey to do the endorsement of Corbett and Cawley to the theme song of Eye of the Tiger. You know, they walked up, standing ovation. Yay! Eye of the Tiger is so 80s. And I thought it was interesting. You know, Cawley gave his little to-do, and, you know, so did Corbett. But Cawley, you know, on the promises theme, you know, basically saying, you know, we told you we were going to do away with lavish government spending and do away with deficits. When the reality is what they've done is they've done away with an economy that was actually growing a little bit. And they've done away with, you know, actual investment in the future. And for what? Well, you know, I think as the Good Jobs First report points out, we're spending, and this blows my mind, we're spending 2.5 times as much handing money out to corporations that we're putting into the state workers' pensions. So for them to say we don't have the money to invest in their pensions, like we're obligated to pay them, seems, well, one, disingenuous, and two, just out and out BS. Now, the Republicans had, you know, a bunch of heavy hitters come in. Congressman Tom Marino was in town, and Hershey gave his little speech, which I thought was interesting. One of the quotes I liked, he said, "Democrats want to erase, as they always do, the good work that Tom Corbett and Jim Cawley have done." And I go, I don't quite remember that. Can you expound on that? Can you give me some examples? He didn't. Can you give me some good examples? You mean like kicking 41,000 low-wage workers off adult basic? You mean kicking 89,000 kids off a chip? You mean eviscerating the general assistance budget, kicking 70,000 of the most vulnerable citizens to the curb, cutting off their only lifeline? Do you mean that stuff? You mean cutting the health and human services budget for, you know, thousands of people across our Commonwealth who needed that lifeline? You mean those good deeds? Is that what you're talking about? No, I'm sure not. I'm sure who he's talking about. Were the huge amounts of handouts to the big corporations. Because understand, the Republican Party has set themselves up to be, they're the employer class. They're, as Fitzpatrick, Congressman Fitzpatrick said, you know, you're one of the people who signed the front of a check, not the back of a check. Because they view themselves as these patriarchs, these superior beings more superior than those working people. And what I found interesting, Marino went on to say we need to tear down the tent and open up the party to everyone. You know, not just the employer class stuff. He says, you know what Republicans have trouble with? Women. Yep, Republicans have trouble with women. Women need to get more involved in politics. Congressman Marino, Republican strategist there. Women need to get more involved in politics. Let me let you know a secret, Representative Marino. Women are involved in politics. While you're trying to screw around and get inside their uterus, and you're trying to keep yourselves in policy-wise in their bedroom and in their personal lives, they're actually organizing. Because what the Republican Party stands for today, very anti-women. I know the whole pro-life thing. You're not getting that vote. I just thought it was interesting that, you know, this guy would come out and say, well, we're having trouble with women. Of course you are, because you're wrong. You're wrong on all the issues and all the policies. It just is what it is. And if you remember last week, I'm not sure if I talked much about this. I know I brought it up, that the House GOP in Washington, that they had their little retreat. They went away, and Eric Cantor evidently gave a speech, a whole spiel, and I was reading some of the transcript stuff from Ed Kilgore over at the Washington Monthly, who pointed out that Cantor was trying to tell the Republicans, you know, how you talk to those people, you know, the people who don't own their businesses and the people who don't view themselves as second-class citizens for working for someone else, you know, those people. People who just want to go and work hard and make a decent living for their families. You know, those people. And he said, you know, these are his words. 90% of America works for someone else. Most of them not only will never own their own business, for most of them that isn't their dream. Their dream is to have a good job with an income that will allow them to support their families. He says, and this is Cantor's brilliant advice, we shouldn't miss a chance to talk to these people. Which is why we will present and pass our plan to relieve the middle class squeeze. And I'm going, whoa. What do you mean the middle class squeeze? What exactly is your view of them? And what are you going to do to relieve this so-called middle class squeeze? Tax cuts for corporations? More deregulation? More insane free trade policies that move jobs overseas, more anti-union legislation, more nonsensical paycheck destruction, more right to work for nothing, you know, more of that stuff. Is that what we're talking about? Because if that's what you're talking about, you're, again, like Marino, wrong. You want to help the middle class? Give them collective bargaining rights. Stop abusing workers' right to organize. That's simple. The only thing, and mark this down. This is reality. And I know the people who have been brought up to hate unions are going to go, oh, he's wrong. No. The only thing that built a middle class in this country is the right of people to collectively bargain, to organize, and to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. That's it. There were no benevolent employers. We've all heard the story of Henry Ford and, oh, how he cared and wanted consumers to a degree, but it was mostly the pressure of workers saying, we want to be able to support ourselves. Without unions, we go back to company script. And I'd say we're already there. Look at the amount of credit card debt. Look at the amount of personal debt that average everyday working class families are saddled with. So maybe it's not direct company script to the company you work for, but it's still company script. And this idea that, oh, well, you know, we're going to help the middle class by doing what? Every Republican policy has been abysmal failure for working people, has been destructive for the middle class. All of this, well, we're pro-business. Okay, be pro-business. But who's pro-working class? Who's pro the guy who's the one who actually does the work? Well, the people that the Republicans are attacking. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the agenda. Because understand, the Republicans who now seem to care about women and care about the middle class, oh, they care so much. They have an agenda. And the agenda, well, it ain't going to help. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. Drowning in crafted lies. Save the USA and resume the ties it binds. Stop taking all our money and shit.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com. And search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Kerr. When Fox News host Bill O'Reilly interviewed President Obama before the Super Bowl, he showcased a laundry list of previously answered questions based on Fox's phony scandals. First up, Benghazi.
He testified that on the day that the ambassador was murdered and the three other Americans, all right, he told Secretary Panetta it was a terrorist attack. Shortly after General Hamm said that, Secretary Panetta came in to you. Yeah. Did he tell you, Secretary Panetta, it was a terrorist attack?
And then the IRS.
Well, Douglas Shulman, former IRS chief, he was cleared into the White House 157 times, more than any of your cabinet members, more than any other IRS guy in the history by far. Okay, why was Douglas Shulman here 157 times? Why?
But Obama pushed back on O'Reilly, pointing out Fox's role in promoting the scandals.
And Bill, that's not what happened. Folks have, again, had multiple hearings on this. These kinds of things keep on surfacing, in part because you and your TV station will promote them.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
We need to stand united, undivided, we shall never fall. Remember all, we need to trust in and then forever call. Our brothers and our sisters, and are you and I aware? You and I both know that we can't rely on it. The time is prime, planets aligned, ain't no mistaken. For union resurrection, the anger has awakened. The way the sleeping giant, come on now, we can do it. We need to revive, re-amp, and re-up the labor movement.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can also email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So the agenda, understand the agenda here. The agenda is more for the wealth class, less for the working class. That's always been the gig. That's been the push of all of the privatization schemes. That's been the push on all the legislation aimed at handing our tax dollars to corporate special interests while taking opportunity from our kids. That's what it's about. It doesn't get any simpler than this. We don't need to complicate it with a whole bunch of nonsense. It is what it is. It's about taking from the future of our kids and giving to the very well-to-do. And, you know, today I was real quick. I was stopped at the gas station to get a soda before I came over to the studio. And I've got my Broncos shirt on because, you know, hey, good, bad, it is what it is, the team I follow. And, you know, I had this conversation with this woman who, you know, said, well, you know, her daughter's a Ravens fan. I go, oh, my favorite billionaire owns the Ravens. And she's like, you have a favorite billionaire? I go, don't you? We all should have favorite billionaires. We created them, right? Through lower wages, lower benefits, working longer hours for less pay, through allowing our jobs to be outsourced and all of that. We've created this mega monster known as the 1%. We should be able to have at least some enjoyment, right? Something, don't you think? And she kind of sat back and go, I guess, you know, what about the guy who owns the Ravens? And I go, well, Stephen Schatz Piscotty made his money the old-fashioned way, outsourcing. He's the billionaire who outsourced jobs. And you could make the argument, a direct argument, that his outsourcing business led to lower wages for millions of people across this country. And thus, higher wages for him, which made him a billionaire. He's worth $1.8 billion. So when I say we created this monster, it's through all of the things that we've been talking about on this program. A tattered social safety net because we have a tax code that doesn't tax the very wealthy at any rates anywhere near the golden age of America. You know, people talk about how wonderful the 50s were. You know, I get a lot of people who pine for that. Oh, you know, everything was wonderful. Leave it to Beaver and all of that. Especially people in my age group. you know, because they remember their, you know, their parents talking about how when they were kids, everything was wonderful. You know, it was fantastic and everything was beautiful and there were parks and there were playgrounds and there were swimming pools and there the Little League and all of this stuff where mom and dad didn't have to shell out money every time you wanted to do something. The communities did it as a matter of course. Healthcare was there because it was community-owned healthcare. All of this stuff was there because it was community-run. It was done by we the people for ourselves without a profit motive and paid for, yes, 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 by the people that we've allowed to become billionaires, the people that we've promoted and built up to be billionaires. That's the reality, like it or not. What's happened since the days of JFK, who dropped the top marginal tax rate down to 70% from the good socialist years of Dwight David Eisenhower, which were 92%. You've seen this corporate assault, this billionaire assault on our tax code. And they throw it out there, oh, we're going to lower taxes. And we in the working class think that means us. It doesn't. Understand that it doesn't mean us. So when you look at the top marginal tax rates, go back to the 50s, and today you're looking at a top marginal tax rate of 92% in the 1950s, down to, what, 35% now? I mean, even it's double even during the Kennedy years, because Kennedy dropped it down to 70. Now, he did, in his defense, he did close a lot of loopholes, which is what gave Reagan the idea to lower it down to 50 and then eventually down to 28 and claim they were closing the loopholes. And then, of course, they got the loopholes all back, and here we are with massive amounts of loopholes that we keep talking about and a tax rate of a paltry number. Look, I'm in favor of high tax rates, but I'm also in favor of big loopholes, incentives, incentivize people to do things. So when I look at the agenda coming forward, we know what it is. It's more privatization. It's more assaults on workers. It's more tax cuts. It's more deregulation. It's honestly more of all of the things that got us into the mess that we're in right now. So when the Republicans keep talking about, well, you know, we need to follow our plan. Well, your plan is what got us into this. You go back and you look at the debt and the deficits we had during the Reagan years. We weren't at $1 billion yet. Yet here we were. Now we're trillions of dollars in debt, a trade deficit that's out of this world, and wages that are continually falling. And you got to ask the question, when does it end? And how much are we willing to take? How much are we willing to fight this? How much are we willing to say, you know, no more? I mean, for me, the Republican agenda, horribly destructive. It just is what it is. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, the RickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. You can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We're in the process of making the demand and making it a strong demand on staples that they put postal employees, APW-represented postal employees, in these retail units.
American Postal Workers Union President Mark Demenstein. In a deal with the U.S. Postal Service, Staples has opened mail service centers in some of their stores. Demenstein says that postal employees are not being used to staff them, and that could put tens of thousands of good jobs at risk. It's a post office privatization thrust, he says, that goes deeper into the retail side than ever before. And he says Staples has had to pay millions of dollars in fines for wage theft of its workers, and Staples' wages are lower with fewer benefits than postal workers get. Demenstein says that outsourcing mail service centers to Staples will hurt the Postal Service, and in coming weeks, the American Postal Workers Union will wage a strong campaign to stop postal work being outsourced to Staples.
Staples is one of these classic corporate companies that has had to pay fines for wage theft of their low-wage employees. In 2010, they had to pay $42 million. They're in the process of lowering the hours of their employees to avoid any obligation under the Affordable Care Act. We think both the people of the United States are going to suffer behind this deal, and obviously a transfer of good-paying union jobs, living wage jobs, to low-wage, non-union, non-benefited, non-living wage jobs is of great concern to our union, and we think to the people of this country as well.
Nearly 1,500 United Auto Workers members from across the U.S., Canada, and Puerto Rico are in Washington, D.C. for the National Community Action Program Legislative Conference. The conference deals with the UAW's legislative and political agenda for the coming year. UAW President Bob King will deliver the keynote speech. U.S. Labor Secretary Thomas Perez and House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi will participate as the union meets with members of Congress. UAW CAP delegates advocating for working families will be lobbying members of Congress during the conference. In Oregon, the Portland Association of Teachers is taking a strike vote on Wednesday. The union and the school district have a mediation session on Friday. Issues include salaries, early retirement incentives, and workload class size issues, among others. The teachers union says it doesn't want to strike, but they're, quote, resolved to do whatever it takes to halt the continued erosion of the teaching and learning conditions in our schools, end quote. All the workers at a Snarf's sandwich shop in Chicago are being rehired and will also get a month's pay. The workers were fired 3 days before Christmas. After they got together and mounted a campaign to get their jobs back with community support, they reached a settlement with Snarf's CEO, Jim Seidel. The workers are announcing the victory at a press conference in Chicago.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We need to cut the way so we can keep taxes down and make sure we have money for critical programs that help our families and our seniors.
I gotta ask the question. You know, what critical programs are we talking about? More tax cuts for big corporations? More handouts to the drillers? Is that what we're talking about? Because you look at the budgets that this governor has put forth the last 3 years, the most vulnerable have been on the menu, not at the table. The only people sitting at the table are the folks who are doing wildly, wildly well. And tomorrow, I don't know that I expect much more of the same. But it is an election year, after all. So the appearance at least has to be there that they're trying, which is why we've asked Michael Wood, research director over at the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center, PennBPC.org, the website. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, certainly. Hey, thanks for having me on.
You know, I look at the last couple of budgets, and I don't think anyone can be even generous in saying that the most vulnerable in the state were even considered when the budgets were put forth.
We've had a tough several years for, you know, our kids and for seniors and, you know, as you said, people who are vulnerable in our state.
So, you know, in looking at the past, you know, couple of years, we just had this conversation with Auditor General DePasquale that, you know, most of us think that, you know, times are tough because, you know, the big collapse in 2008, thanks to the Bush people. You know, you look at all of this, you tighten the belt, you know, we'll sacrifice so that the future will be better. Our kids will have better off. That's not really what's happened. I mean, all of the cuts that the governor put forth have actually made things, appears to me, much worse.
We've seen very little evidence of the tax cuts that have been provided for corporations, generally speaking, as providing economic growth in the state and helping people find jobs.
So as we're looking at all of this resource that we've spent, one could argue that it could have been much better spent than just allowing to go out through a little loophole, a little mailbox in Delaware or through the drill bits up in the Marcellus shale fields, right?
Yeah, we've had some interesting economic choices in terms of like what we want to encourage in the state. You know, there has been a very mild effort to close some tax loopholes. At the same time, we've given away even more tax breaks while we bring back a little bit of money, we give away, you know, several times more in new breaks. So, and then also talking about the Marcellus Shale, you know, obviously this is we're the third biggest producer of natural gas in the United States. the only one in of the large producers that doesn't have any kind of major tax that comes into the state from that. You know, most states would be that have this kind of energy production are doing quite well. Pennsylvania isn't reaping the benefit of it, at least from a state tax point of view.
Explain that a little bit better so people understand it. Because, you know, I look at North Dakota where, you know, it's just wild boom and everything's wonderful. And you look at Texas and other states because, you know, the governor wants us to be the Texas of the Northeast. How well are they doing then?
Both of those states have pretty sizable budget surpluses this year, in North Dakota in particular. They are bringing a lot of money in from their severance tax that's going to help support state services. Helping, you know, it's big economic activity there. The state's getting the share of that economic activity. Pennsylvania, it's very much trickle down economics and how much of what the state's going to get. And so far, the trickle has been just a trickle.
So let me ask you this, because the frame that I keep hearing, Michael, is that all people like me want to do is kill the golden goose because everything's so wonderful. But what I'm hearing from you is other places are doing the almost same thing and are in much better shape. So the question is, why?
That's a very good question, and I think one that we really need to figure out as a commonwealth.
Is it because, now I've seen reports saying that we have probably one of the lowest, call it whatever you want, severance fees, impact taxes, taxes in general, we have one of the lowest amounts coming from that resource that's being sucked out from our ground going to our government.
Yep, that's the case. And most states have property taxes that help pay for local governments. Pennsylvania, we have an impact fee that a lot of that goes to local governments. But then in other states, they'll have a severance tax, and usually that goes to help pay for health care and environmental protection and education. And Pennsylvania has decided to forego that revenue source.
So are we spending, in looking at states that do the same kind of thing that's going on here with the Marcellus Shale, are we spending comparable money on environmental protection, on making sure that we don't relive the history of the coal industry?
I think that most of the states that are doing this kind of thing probably aren't spending enough on environmental protection. So it remains to be seen, I think, over time. I think I'm not sure we've quite learned our lesson on that.
Yeah, because what I've seen, and I agree that the states aren't doing enough, but as I've been finding, we're actually worse off than the other states. And in fact, you know, I've got a friend who tells me that we're actually pulling West Virginia down.
Very well could be true. I know we have had, there have not been that many new inspectors that have been hired to help look at these wells. If you look at the number of wells versus the number of inspectors, it's very hard for them to go in and really keep tabs of these things. You know, you find out when there's already been an accident or some other problem. You know, it's just, it ends up being kind of dealing in damage control mode as opposed to, like, stopping things from happening beforehand.
Yeah, you're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Michael Wood, Research Director over at the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center. Their website, PennBPC.org. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Michael's name. It'll take you right there. So tomorrow, the big speech, what are we expecting?
Well, I think we're probably going to see a kinder, gentler budget than we've seen from the governor in the last few years.
Well, it is an election year, after all.
It is an election year, so I think that is, you know, I think people have been beat up, rightfully so, for the cuts that have been in the last three budgets. And just from what we've heard from the administration sources, that they feel like the days of big cuts, at least for this year, are over. And they want to come forward with something that has, like, some small increases in some popular programs. You know, certainly those are better than cuts than we've seen before. The question in our mind is, how are these things paid for, and for how long are they paid for? Are we doing just an election year kind of smoke and mirrors thing to be able to pay for it, balance it this year, and then let next year's problem be next year's problem? Are we kicking the pension debt that's due? Are we going to continue to pay on that and continue to live up to, you know, the employer's side of their obligation for paying for this? Or is it going to kick the can down the road, as they like to say in Harrisburg, so they can, you know, be able to redirect that money somewhere else?
So what you're saying is, and I think we talked about this with the Auditor General for a minute real quick, that the rumor is the governor's thinking about not making the pension payment that the state is obligated to make, and then you taking that money, as we had done for nearly a decade, and using it for something else.
That is what we have been hearing also. You know, it's sort of like making half of a credit card payment.
So, in essence, what we're doing is, and I guess this to me falls right into the Republican MO of we're going to make the problem much, much worse so that it gets to crisis level so that there's no alternative but to destroy it.
Hopefully it doesn't get to that point. That seems like the direction that we're going if you end up keep changing, you know, if we keep paying less than we should. At some point, you know, the employees have been paying their share on the pensions from day one. And it's the employer in this sense, either the state or, you know, looking at local governments that help pay for this. You know, they haven't been paying as much as they should be.
All right. Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, we've had all this pain the last couple of years. They've kicked 41,000 people off of adult basic, low wage workers off of adult basic, you know, some 89,000 kids off of CHIP, 70,000 people off of the general assistance budget. You go down the list, all of the cuts to Health and Human Services, the 20,000 education workers kicked to the curb, all of these painful, draconian, economy killing cuts. It hasn't made us any better off, I don't think. And, in fact, I would argue it makes us much worse off. So with all of these cuts, are we anywhere near balancing our budget? Are we anywhere near having some balance? Do we have a surplus? What's our situation?
Well, going into, like, a couple months ago, the budget secretary had a mid-year review where they looked at what the state's revenue was doing and what the projections looked like for either for this year and for next year in terms of revenue coming in. And also the Independent Fiscal Office, a separate body, has taken a look at it and done some projections over the next few years. And both of them have found that Pennsylvania is in what they call a structural deficit. That means that we don't have, even in good times, we don't have enough tax revenue coming in to be able to pay for just the basic things that the state spends money on.
Hold on here. Structurally, so what is that? That means that we have a screwed up tax code.
We have a screwed up tax code where we don't bring in enough money, even when the economy is doing well, to be able to pay for just the basic things with paying for our schools and pay for health care and paying for public safety, you name it.
So in essence, the Tea Party people are right. We're broke, but we've done it to ourselves. We've allowed the ideology of the lower taxes and cut taxes for corporations and all that stuff to basically voluntarily starve ourselves.
Yes, it's, you know, as a lot of people on the right like to say, starving the beast by making sure that it doesn't have enough money to be able to operate in a normal way. And, you know, I think they've been fairly successful.
So what's the way forward out of that then? I mean, because, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, you know, the Bush collapse in 2008 really screwed up the pension system and screwed up basically everybody's budgets. But what you're saying is completely different, that structurally it doesn't even matter. If we're in the boom years of the Clinton years, we're still not going to be able to pay our bills.
Yeah, and one of the main reasons for that is we have taken our the tax revenue, particularly from corporations, and given so much of that away that we're not seeing when the economy is growing, the state, again, is not growing with that, like, that resource. So it ends up being the state's basically financed through sales tax and through personal income tax, usually on just regular everyday people.
So let me clarify that, because you said something that just caught my attention, that we're giving away so much. If we stopped giving all of these handouts to these big corporations, if we didn't give $1.7 billion to Royal Dutch Shell, and we didn't give the millions of dollars to that company that came from Phillipsburg, New Jersey, across the river to Easton, if we didn't do that, would we be okay?
Yes. That was the interesting thing with the Independent Fiscal Office report. It was basically said that if corporate taxes grew at the same rate as every other tax source that the state has, we would have virtually no deficit going in the next few years. Our revenues and our expenditures would match up pretty well. We'd be able to balance the budget without a heck of a lot of pain. But we're just making it worse for ourselves every year by continually cutting taxes, particularly for businesses.
Oh, but wait, hold on. Well, but I've been told, and I hope I'm wrong, but we've got the largest, the most huge, most onerous tax structure in the whole total country. We're the most taxed state in the country for businesses. They're so burdened here in Pennsylvania, I've heard.
Well, you know, I guess I'm sure that's what they'd like people to think. You know, in terms of the corporate net income tax, which is kind of the big tax that we have on businesses, it has a fairly high rate on it, one of the highest rates in the country, and if you look at the tax rate. The The problem is very few corporations pay that. Something like 70% of corporations pay nothing in corporate net income tax. And the other, we had another kind of tax that was like a property tax that was on businesses, and that's been over the last 15 years reduced down from, it used to be this rate of 12.99 mils, and it's now less than one. So, you know, like a 90-some percent rate cut over the last 15 years. No replacement revenue for that. That's billions of dollars each year that we're losing by not collecting that tax that we used to collect. And there's no replacement revenue for it. It's kind of hard to pay your bills when you give all your money away.
Evidently. You know, I look at this, and what it says to me is we've given away all of this resource. And who suffers? Well, our kids suffer, our infrastructure suffers, and the future of the Commonwealth suffers for short-term gain for folks probably not even from the state. That's what frustrates me, I think, the most. That most of the money that was supposed to fund our infrastructure and schools and all that seems to be going through that magic box in Delaware and just poof, it's gone.
Yeah, you know, if we have these tax breaks, and it's not like the companies have to really do anything to get them. They just operate the way that they normally do. And they pay less in tax than they did the year before, and they keep the money. Doesn't mean that it's being reinvested in Pennsylvania. They're going to invest wherever they're going to make the most money, and they continue to do that.
So tomorrow, do we expect more of the same on the corporate tax break? Do we expect him to come out and say, oh, we brought businesses to Pennsylvania, and it only cost us, you know, an arm or a leg?
I'm interested to see. I think they had a big tax proposal last year, and that seemed to fall apart, thankfully, as leveler heads prevailed. After looking at the long-term costs of this, people made some good decisions in terms of the state's fiscal planning and paring that back down to something that is at least manageable where it wasn't before. I imagine that you'll probably see some new tax credits be proposed, probably not, you know, huge amounts of money compared to what's been proposed in prior years. You know, I think the fiscal situation is pretty dire this next year, and I think that they kind of had to scrape, you know, get all the coins out of the seat cushions from the sofa to be able to come up with a way to balance it, at least for next year. In the years going forward, I'm very interested to see what's in the plan and see if it's a one-time fix or if it's something that's going to be a long-term fix. My guess is probably I think the idea is let's get through the election and we'll settle the real problems another day.
Right, and I look at it, and my view on it, it's going to be very soft. It's going to have a lot of talking, a lot of things that they can run on, because the record of the last 3 years, not really all that good.
Yeah, not very positive. You know, if you have kids in the school district and they see all the cuts and you've had to deal with, you know, what the impact of that is, it's pretty hard, you know, for people to believe that, oh, we're spending, you know, as the administration likes to say, that they're spending more on education than it's ever been spent before. You know, people who have kids in the classroom see it's not making it down to the schools if that's the case.
Yeah, well, I'm seeing bigger class sizes. I'm seeing less extracurriculars. And my kids are seeing it right now. My daughter's in sixth grade, and they're in this thing called LGI, large group instruction with 100 kids. I'm going, sixth grade? We've already got university-style education in sixth grade.
Wow.
But, hey, you know, they spend more time on prepping for the test because we know what's really important. But, Mike, I appreciate the time. Appreciate you giving us your insight and look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Very good, Rick. Have a great evening.
Thanks so much. Michael Wood, Research Director at the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm, on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Assume that you ran a business that was found guilty of bribery, forgery, perjury, defrauding homeowners, fleecing investors, swindling consumers, cheating credit card holders, violating U.S. trade laws, and bilking American soldiers. Can you even imagine the punishment you'd get? How about zero? No jail time, not even a fine. Plus, you get to stay on as boss. You get to keep all the loot you gain from the crime spree, and you even get a $8.5 million pay raise. Of course, you and I would never get such outrageous, absurd, kid-glove pampering by legal authorities. But then, we're not the capo of J.P. Morgan Chase, America's biggest bank and a crime syndicate that apparently is too big to jail. Jamie Dimon is the slick CEO who has fostered a culture of thievery during his years as a top executive at J.P. Morgan, leading to that shameful litany of crime. Yet, federal prosecutors have bowed to the politically connected Wall Streeter, refusing to ruffle his feathers with even a single criminal charge. Meanwhile, one of the scams that Dimon directly supervised produced a $6 billion loss for shareholders in 2012. And his reign of mismanagement and illegalities cost the bank's shareholders another $20 billion in federal fines last year, resulting in a 16% drop in profits. You might think the bank's board of directors would at least slap Jamie's wrist for the loss of those billions, but no. In January, they rewarded him, raising his pay by some 70% to a sweet $20 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, the New York Times noted that to ordinary Americans, such a reward for a poor performance, quote, may seem curious. Curious? Uh-uh. Try incomprehensible, insane, and immoral. Wall Street's haughty elites continue to demonstrate that they're common mobsters, only not so ethical. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Fighting for what is right. And you know what I've been seeing, you know, and I look at this budget, and tomorrow there's a lot I'm expecting out of the governor's address. One of it is, you know, hey, gotta make the kinder, softer governor. You know, and talk about things that, oh, hey, wonderful things that they did. Yet I think it's gonna be a real stretch. You know, I know they've been running around saying, you know, promises kept. You know, the promises that were kept, they promised, I don't know who, but they promised somebody that they were going to go after the most vulnerable. And I guess the question is, are you okay with that? I know we have been sold this idea that it's the poor's fault. You know, they're poor for a reason because they're lazy, or they're poor for a reason because, they're just them. What I find interesting, and I saw this report of people living in Detroit. Now, Detroit has become the face of poverty here over the last, probably the last generation, as deindustrialization has shipped jobs overseas, as the auto industry has fled Michigan and really fled the United States. Along with it, the entire parts sector, because remember, and this is important to remember, if you remember the whole Delphi situation several years back, the Chinese had targeted auto parts as an industry that they wanted to take over. So for a number of years, they were buying up companies. For a number of years, they were heavily subsidizing their parts industry, which ended up making the U.S. auto parts tank. Now, we lost, I think it was some 450,000 jobs as part of that. So when you see this kind of disinvestment in the U.S., and this hyper-investment by the Chinese government in an industry that has basically cornered the entire market. When you see this, along with the urban flight, along with all of the problems that a Rust Belt city like Detroit has, and a state that's ready to walk away from them, and really a conservative movement that wants it. I mean, how many times have you heard, how many statements have you heard recently about wall off Detroit, either put the immigrants there or put Indians there or, you know, put African Americans there? This whole idea of just make a compound and stuff them all in there. Those people. Sad reality. Right now, the child mortality rates in Detroit are higher than a number of third world countries. The Detroit News did a study recently, working with national health departments, and what they found is that Detroit has this really very high child death rate. In fact, you know, you look at the city of 713,000, it is the only city in the U.S. with somewhere near 100 deaths per 100,000 kids. One of the doctors who was interviewed and was part of this said it's a public health emergency. He said that 120 out of every 100,000 kids died in 2010. That means you've got an infant mortality rate higher than Panama, higher than Romania, higher than Botswana. And, you know, you go through and you look at this. Between 2000 and 2011, you had 23 infants who died in the first year of life. Within that first year, between... Where are my pro-life friends there? And this is one of those things that gets me. Because, you know, you have a whole bunch of people saying, well, you know, we're pro-life and we want to make sure that, you know, all these, all the babies who are conceived are born. What happens after they're born? And I've asked this question, you know, thousands of times. What happens after they're born? What then? Do we get them the health care that they need? Do we get them the shots, the vaccinations? When they're sick, do they get to see a doctor? I mean, and this isn't me being on any political spectrum. This is me asking a serious question. What do you do? Where are my pro-life friends who tell me that we need to protect the sanctity of life? Yet here in a major U.S. city, you have, and to me this is a national disgrace, you have what I would actually argue as well as a public health emergency. When you've got that many people, because of being poor, who die within the first year of life. I just got an email from Janet, who writes, you know, being poor is knowing exactly how much everything costs. Being poor is knowing that your kids, when they make a mistake, could affect their entire lives. And Janet sent me a whole list of being what being poor means in this country. She writes, being poor is hoping a toothache will go away. Being poor is knowing that when your kids go to friends' houses, that their friends are never going to come to your house. Being poor is living next to a freeway. Being poor is buying off-brand toys. Being poor is heating a home one room at a time. Being poor is Goodwill underwear. And the thing is what's interesting to me is, you know, as I'm looking through these things that she's right. I don't know where she got all these or if she made them up herself, but she's right. You know, being poor is thinking $8 an hour is probably a good deal. Being poor is relying on people who don't give a damn about you. I remember this stuff as a kid. And I can't imagine an entire city struggling. Because, you know, when you have that kind of situation, it's that kind of situation for a lot of people. Not just the very poor, but for working class people. So I'd be interested, my pro-life friends, rick@thericksmithshow.com, your thoughts. Is it okay? You know, 100, 120 out of every 100,000 births. It happens, right? God's will, right? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a quick break right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
From a firefighter's my friend, and the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not going to break tonight, and we're not going to bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, a union town. All down the line, this is a union town, a union town. All down the line, and if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, a union town. All down the line.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We're in the process of making the demand and making it a strong demand on staples that they put postal employees, APW representatives, and postal employees in these retail units.
American Postal Workers Union President Mark Demenstein. In a deal with the U.S. Postal Service, Staples has opened mail service centers in some of their stores. Demenstein says that postal employees are not being used to staff them, and that could put tens of thousands of good jobs at risk. It's a post office privatization thrust, he says, that goes deeper into the retail side than ever before. And he says Staples has had to pay millions of dollars in fines for wage theft of its workers, and Staples' wages are lower, with fewer benefits than postal workers get. Demenstein says that outsourcing mail service centers to Staples will hurt the Postal Service, and in coming weeks, the American Postal Workers Union will wage a strong campaign to stop postal work being outsourced to Staples.
Staples is one of these classic corporate companies that has had to pay fines for wage theft of their low-wage employees. In 2010, they had to pay $42 million. They're in the process of lowering the hours of their employees to avoid any obligation under the Affordable Care Act. We think both the people of the United States are going to suffer behind this deal, and obviously a transfer of good-paying union jobs, living wage jobs, to low-wage, non-union, non-benefited, non-living wage jobs is of great concern to our union, and we think to the people of this country as well.
Nearly 1,500 United Auto Workers members from across the U.S., Canada, and Puerto Rico are in Washington, D.C. for the National Community Action Program Legislative Conference. The conference deals with the UAW's legislative and political agenda for the coming year. UAW President Bob King will deliver the keynote speech. U.S. Labor Secretary Thomas Perez and House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi will participate as the union meets with members of Congress. UAW CAP delegates advocating for working families will be lobbying members of Congress during the conference. In Oregon, the Portland Association of Teachers is taking a strike vote on Wednesday. The union and the school district have a mediation session on Friday. Issues include salaries, early retirement incentives, and workload class size issues, among others. The teachers' union says it doesn't want to strike, but they're, quote, resolved to do whatever it takes to halt the continued erosion of the teaching and learning conditions in our schools, end quote. All the workers at a Snarf's sandwich shop in Chicago are being rehired and will also get a month's pay. The workers were fired 3 days before Christmas. After they got together and mounted a campaign to get their jobs back with community support, they reached a settlement with Snarf's CEO, Jim Seidel. The workers are announcing the victory at a press conference in Chicago.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
One of the objectives we have over the next couple months is to help folks understand some of the circumstances that lead folks to a life of poverty. It could just be one bad decision or one unfortunate circumstance that spirals to a life of poverty. And we hope to examine what those decisions are, what barriers are keeping folks in poverty, and helping to eliminate some of those barriers in the future for individuals and families across the state.
Sanity, yes. That would be something nice in our politics, wouldn't it? It'd be something nice from our policymakers. Just a little bit of sanity, maybe a little understanding, maybe, you know, maybe remembering that things aren't as easy for most people. I mean, you keep hearing these frames, and I've been taking, you know, Janet sent me this email, and I've been taking a look at a number of the things that she sent on this idea, you know, of being poor and what being poor means. And, you know, a couple of them that, you know, caught my attention is, you know, being poor is a $200 paycheck advance from a company that takes $250 when the paycheck comes in. Again, being poor, part of being very, very costly. And it made me think of Elizabeth Warren's piece over the weekend. Don't know if you saw this. The Democratic senator from Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, had a piece over at, I think it was Huffington Post, where she talks about a report that was just put out by the Office of the Inspector General at the U.S. Postal Service, who claims, according to the report, that somewhere in the neighborhood of 68 million people in this country, they're saying more than a quarter of the population, more than a quarter of the entire population, they don't have a checking or savings account. I mean, think about that. I mean, for most middle-class families, for most people, you know, like me, the idea of not being able to have a savings account or a bank account, walking into the whatever and signing up for one of these accounts just seems ludicrous. How can you not? But then I remembered being a kid. I remembered my neighborhood. Now, this was the 70s, and things have not changed since the 70s. There wasn't a bank in my neighborhood. There wasn't a credit union. There wasn't an easily accessible financial institution that would cash checks. And what she points out is that, and I guess this is according to the OIG report, that these 68 million people spent somewhere in the neighborhood of, and this is mind-blowing, $89 billion in 2012 on interest and fees for non-bank financial services. You know, like payday loans and these check cashing places and stuff. Stuff where you go, you know, you got your EBT card, and everybody loves it. Oh, it's those people are, you know, those cheats, those welfare cheats with their EBT cards. I love the fact that, you know, we give them to people, and they give you like the first one free, and then they whack you every time you use it. So every time you go to the store, if you're like me who wants to kind of break up the shopping, the grocery shopping, because look, you know, when I remember as a kid, you would go and you would go to the store once because you usually got one ride a month from somebody you could finagle with, or you had the ability to try it. You know, maybe once you wanted to pay for the cab ride to the grocery store. So you would buy a whole bunch of stuff, and you would stock up, and everything would be full for the month. And then about 2 weeks, 2.5, 3 weeks in, it was all gone. And then there would be nothing left for a couple of days at the end of the month. Nothing, literally nothing. And then you would do this again, this whole cycle of doing this insanity. So if you're one of these people who wants to, like me, say, okay, every week I'm going to buy this much stuff, and this will, I'm going to spread it out and kind of plan for it, they're going to rob you blind. Because you're going to want four charges. Well, they don't want that. $89 billion they stole from poor people. I mean, that's really what it was. And in fact, what Elizabeth Warren points out is it's about $2,412 per household on average. And what she says, that's an average of about 10% of the annual income of folks in this category. She points out it's about the same amount that people spend on food. And you go, wow. I mean, put that into perspective. Think about this for a second. What she's saying, and what the Office of the Inspector General is saying, is that being poor in this country means that you're spending almost the same amount of money on food as you're giving to these banks and these financial ripoff artists for you to access your money. Think about that for a second. You go to work, you work at the local crummy wage place, you know, making minimum wage, which isn't covering enough to do anything. And then to cash the check, then, then you've got to pay to access your money, or you've got to go to a check cashing place that's going to charge you a percentage, you know, a pretty healthy percentage. And heaven forbid that you need to make it to the next week and you want a payday loan. Now, we've been ripping off the poor for far too long. And what the Office of the Inspector General is saying, and, you know, there's part of me that goes, so the post office wants to get in on doing this, on robbing people. But what they're saying is what they want to do is, you know, you've got these people who are trapped in areas that have nothing in the way of a financial institution that they can be part of. The post office is saying, well, you know what, maybe we get involved in that. And as Elizabeth Warren writes, the OIG explored the possibilities of the U.S. United States Postal Service offering basic banking services, you know, like bill paying, check cashing, small loans for a very, very reasonably small fee, because you've already got the post offices in these neighborhoods. You've already got the workforce in these neighborhoods. And what she writes is the U.S. Postal Service could partner with banks to make what she says, a critical difference for millions of Americans that don't have banking services in their areas, or, you know, no banks or branches in the neighborhoods. And, you know, I'm not against the idea. I think it's worth anything that we can get to compete against these big banks. To me, seems like the push in the right direction. I'm just kind of a little leery of this idea that we're going to then make the Postal Service. Because understand, there's this push to privatizing the Postal Service. There's this push to getting it into the Staples and into the stores. And I got to wonder, you know, at what point does... Because look, I'm of the mindset that corporate America, they know how to get to the dollar. They know how to get their money out of you, because they believe it's all their money. Understand that. It is. It's all their money, and you're just holding on to it for a very short period of time to make you think like you have something. Part of me worries that, you know, this push towards privatizing the Postal Service could encompass part of this. And I, you know me. I'm very, very cynical of these kind of things. But, you know, having been someone who lived in a neighborhood like that had nothing. I mean, you had the check cashing, the pawn shops, you had all that stuff. No banks. Nothing that we in the middle class, nothing that, you know, things that I take for granted. I mean, I do business with a couple of banks. Not banks. I'm sorry. Let me correct that. I would never go to a bank. I go to a credit union. A completely different animal. A little bit of, you know, the illusion of some say. In fact, one of our advertisers here, I am a big fan of. I've got, you know, my accounts with them and have had my accounts with PSECU for years, long before they were an advertiser on the program. But, you know, the thing is, you know, not everyone has that fortune, and it's easy to forget that. But when I saw that number, $89 billion. And interest and things that, like, payday loans, $89 billion in 1 year. That is just absolutely, without a doubt, a staggeringly mind-blowing number. And I guess it goes back to the frame that being poor is not having a bank account. Being poor is having to use a payday lender. And going back to Janet's email, she points out that being poor is people who have never been poor wondering why you choose to be. Being poor is seeing how few options you actually have. It's interesting. You know, and I think the people who point their finger, and this is where maybe I'm going to have to give some people a pass, but not an absolute pass. A pass of ignorance, a pass of a lack of compassion, a pass of stupidity, I guess, on a certain level. But the people who point their fingers and go, "Wow, it's your fault, you're poor," or point their finger and ask, you know, "Why are you poor? Why don't you do something about it?" Structurally, the game's rigged. If you grow, and look, the ladder is being kicked out from under us every day. And not just for poor people, for people in the middle class. staying in the middle class has become extraordinarily hard. And for me, it all comes back down to a lot of the politicians that we've put into office and a lot of the policies that we've allowed them to pursue. It's, to me, just that simple. I'd be interested in your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts, your comments, your questions, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Own 90% of the wealth. 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Assume that you ran a business that was found guilty of bribery, forgery, perjury, defrauding homeowners, fleecing investors, swindling consumers, cheating credit card holders, violating U.S. trade laws, and bilking American soldiers. Can you even imagine the punishment you'd get? How about zero? No jail time, not even a fine. Plus, you get to stay on as boss. You get to keep all the loot you gain from the crime spree, and you even get an $8.5 million pay raise. Of course, you and I would never get such outrageous, absurd, kid-glove pampering by legal authorities. But then, we're not the capo of J.P. Morgan Chase, America's biggest bank and a crime syndicate that apparently is too big to jail. Jamie Dimon is the slick CEO who has fostered a culture of thievery during his years as a top executive at J.P. Morgan, leading to that shameful litany of crime. Yet, federal prosecutors have bowed to the politically connected Wall Streeter, refusing to ruffle his feathers with even a single criminal charge. Meanwhile, one of the scams that Dimon directly supervised produced a $6 billion loss for shareholders in 2012. And his reign of mismanagement and illegalities cost the bank's shareholders another $20 billion in federal fines last year, resulting in a 16% drop in profits. You might think the bank's board of directors would at least slap Jamie's wrist for the loss of those billions, but no. In January, they rewarded him, raising his pay by some 70% to a sweet $20 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, the New York Times noted that to ordinary Americans, such a reward for a poor performance, quote, may seem curious. Curious? Try incomprehensible, insane, and immoral. Wall Street's haughty elites continue to demonstrate that they're common mobsters, only not so ethical. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. You know, I look at, you know, the argument going on right now in the state. Paycheck protection! You know, I've heard this a bunch of times. The fact that we've got a movement here in the Republican-led General Assembly to go after this euphemistically named thing, paycheck protection. When we know what it is. It's a ripoff. It's deception. It's destruction. It's all of those things. But even more nefarious than that, even more grotesque, even more poisonous, it's an attack on what built the American middle class. It's an attack on what my grandparents' generation fought for. Now, I go back to today, back in 1941. Our Supreme Court upheld the Fair Labor Standards Act that banned child labor, that established the 40-hour work week, and gave actual protection to people's paychecks. I wonder, and I'm very curious, if such a law given the Supreme Court's makeup, could be passed today. I wonder if, given the makeup of our General Assembly, if given the makeup of Congress, especially in the House, I wonder if banning child labor could happen today. I look around the country and you talk to worker, low-wage workers especially, and study after study, poll after poll shows large amounts of low-wage workers being cheated out of their paycheck, which is why I keep asking. This paycheck protection that the Republicans keep talking about, what protection is it? Is there protection against wage theft? Is there any protection in there against making people work through their breaks and assault on their hours? Any protection whatsoever? Any protection of, you know, of my favorite one last year that they passed and got signed, where you pay your state taxes and you think that you're paying your state taxes to the state and they're using that money for, you know, the things that we expect, you know, like plowing the roads and fixing the roads and educating our children, all those things. When in reality, what you're doing is you're paying it back to the company you work for. Tax break. Thank you. So I look at this, and you look around the country, and you see time and time again all of these incidents of wage theft. And yesterday, the story broke this morning that in New York City, one of these big Domino's franchise owners agreed to pay almost $1.3 million to 61 workers that basically, according to reports, he ripped off. The company was allegedly, I guess that we have to use the alleged word, allegedly he cheated these workers out of wages. The average award, the award is going to range somewhere between $400 and $61,000, depending on how long each of these workers work for the company. The lawsuit went and said that the company withheld pay by, and this is common practice, by making them pay for their uniforms and to do work that would not be covered under the tipped portion, because understand there's two different, especially when you're working in fast food or in food in restaurants, there's the tipped wage and the non-tipped wage. So like if you're outside cleaning or you're doing some, you're supposed to be paid the minimum wage, but if you're actually serving food and where there's a possibility that you're going to get a tip, then they pay you the lower tipped wage. Now in New York, the minimum wage is $8 an hour and the tipped rate is $5 an hour. On the federal level, this is even worse. On the federal level, you got 7.25 is the minimum wage, but $2.13 is the minimum wage for tipped employees, which I gotta be honest is wow. I don't know how you exist on this. I remember going back to when I was in college and my, the girl I dated back then worked in one of the little tavern kind of restaurant things. She made the $2.13 an hour back then. I think it was $1.80 she made. Because I think it went up in 96 to $2.13. But she made like a $1.80 or something an hour. And she never got a paycheck. Never got a paycheck. That $1.80 an hour went to pay taxes. Because they had, and this is how I know so much about this, what they had done is the system was set up that they would take 8% of your checks. So if you went in, you spent $10, right? You go in, you spend $10, they would take 8%. So they would say you got like an 80-cent tip. And what if you didn't? You know, what if you got 15 cents or you got nothing? Well, they still taxed you at that 8%. And, you know, she walked out of there, you know, she'd have money in her pocket from the end of the night, but she never got a paycheck. So I look at this and you see the people who abuse this, because it's there. It's easily abused. While you're a tipped employee, you can do all of this other work. And then we don't have to hire this person. Now, according to the lawsuit, one of the plaintiffs, a guy named Carlos Rodriguez Herrera, he said that he went to the manager, complained about the fact that he was being cheated on his pay in 2007 and was on the spot fired immediately. And, you know, people think, well, you can't be fired for that. Well, not supposed to. Supposed to be one of those things that you're protected by some law. Went to the State Department of Labor. They didn't do anything after a couple of years. Then went on to legal aid. And they're the people who, you know, throughout this time, then took the lawsuit into court. And this is where I say we need to be funding the Labor Department much more. Because, look, I don't think it was because they didn't want to pursue this. I think it was because they're overworked and they're understaffed. And this is just one of many claims that they just didn't have time to get through. Now, according to the report I saw, another 24 workers back in December claimed that for the exact same thing, they were fired for speaking up. And for me, the first thing that pops out, and you know where I'm going with this, the first thing that pops into my mind is, if you had a union, if you had a contract, if you had right there before you a collective bargaining agreement, that couldn't happen. And it wouldn't get to the point to where you're talking about a $61,000 in back pay from being cheated week after week, month after month, year after year. And I point back to the survey that was done, I guess it was last year sometime, where they pointed out that nearly 85% of all the fast food workers in New York City reported being ripped off. And I go back to the paycheck protection. Where is the paycheck? I want real paycheck protection. Now, we've seen these stories all across. It doesn't matter. Every industry. Federal contract workers, Walmart subcontractors, Walmart workers, exotic dancers, cheerleaders, you name it. People are, if you give the boss the ability to rip these people off, it's going to happen. Now, you may think, well, we take them to court, we fight, we win, right? And this is what I'm kind of expecting here for Carlos and the other 60 workers who this Domino's franchise has agreed to pay $1.2 million to. In California, people who won wage theft claims, 83% of them never saw a dime. Never saw a dime. And you wonder, and you go back and you wonder why there are so many fast food workers out in the streets. You go out and you wonder why there's this unrest. Because I keep saying at some point, we get tired. At some point, we get fed up, and we've had enough. And maybe this is now. Maybe now people are going to have enough. Because, you know, I go back and I remember, you know, like when I met my wife. She was a volunteer tour guide on a horse ride. And all of the tipped money that we thought we were giving to the guides actually went to the person who owned the horses. It's amazing. Quick break, right back with hour three. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to the Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We're in the process of making the demand and making it a strong demand on staples that they put postal employees, APW-represented postal employees, in these retail units.
American Postal Workers Union President Mark Demenstein
In a deal with the U.S. Postal Service, Staples has opened mail service centers in some of their stores. Demenstein says that postal employees are not being used to staff them, and that could put tens of thousands of good jobs at risk. It's a post office privatization thrust, he says, that goes deeper into the retail side than ever before. And he says Staples has had to pay millions of dollars in fines for wage theft of its workers, and Staples' wages are lower, with fewer benefits than postal workers get. Demenstein says that outsourcing mail service centers to Staples will hurt the Postal Service, and in coming weeks, the American Postal Workers Union will wage a strong campaign to stop postal work being outsourced to Staples.
The Staples is one of these classic corporate companies that has had to pay fines for wage theft of their low-wage employees. In 2010, they had to pay $42 million. They're in the process of lowering the hours of their employees to avoid any obligation under the Affordable Care Act. We think both the people of the United States are going to suffer behind this deal, and obviously a transfer of good-paying union jobs, living wage jobs, to low-wage, non-union, non-benefited, non-living wage jobs is of great concern to our union, and we think to the people of this country as well.
Nearly 1,500 United Auto Workers members from across the U.S., Canada, and Puerto Rico are in Washington, D.C. for the National Community Action Program Legislative Conference. The conference deals with UAW's legislative and political agenda for the coming year. UAW President Bob King will deliver the keynote speech. U.S. Labor Secretary Thomas Perez and House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi will participate as the union meets with members of Congress. UAW CAP delegates advocating for working families will be lobbying members of Congress during the conference. In Oregon, the Portland Association of Teachers is taking a strike vote on Wednesday. The union and the school district have a mediation session on Friday. Issues include salaries, early retirement incentives, and workload class size issues, among others. The teachers' union says it doesn't want to strike, but they're, quote, resolved to do whatever it takes to halt the continued erosion of the teaching and learning conditions in our schools, end quote. All the workers at a Snarf's sandwich shop in Chicago are being rehired and will also get a month's pay. The workers were fired 3 days before Christmas. After they got together and mounted a campaign to get their jobs back with community support, they reached a settlement with Snarf's CEO, Jim Seidel. The workers are announcing the victory at a press conference in Chicago.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Thank you. The National Labor Relations Act was a New Deal initiative which helped save American capitalism by creating a process which would protect the rights of employees and employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S. Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing in Washington State, but we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina, because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' rights to free speech, take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America. Hey!
No, I gotta be honest, I really like that guy. In fact, you know, I go back to when I was a kid, I'm proud to say that I actually handed out flyers, to help him become mayor as a young child. Just a guy who really, kind of a strange looking guy and a strange acting guy, but a guy who passionate about working people, passionate about the folks who work for a living. And the families that depend on those jobs and the work that the folks do. I give that guy nothing but the utmost credit, and I hope him nothing but the best, because you look at what the gerrymandering did to him, pitted him against Marcy Kaptur in Ohio, and you know the big money came just to take him out, because he, you know, I like Marcy Kaptur. There's some things that, yeah, a little questionable, but for the most part I like her. Big fan of Dennis though. Big fan of Dennis Kucinich. Would have liked to. Now, here's the thing. You know, had we real thinking voters, that guy could have been president. had we turned off the idiot box, had we turned off the political pundits, and had we listened to the facts, had we listened to ideas, had we really thought about who would do the best thing for working people in this country, it would have been that guy. And I go back year after year, election after election, and constantly we're given the choice between less bad and, oh my God, horrible. We're given the choice of H.W. Bush and Clinton. We're given the choice of Dukakis, H.W. Bush. We're given the choice of Al Gore or George W. Bush. We're given the choice of John Kerry or George W. Bush. We're given the choice of President Obama or Mitt Romney. EPI has an interesting piece out. We're told quite often that, we got to get a good education. I tell my kids this all the time, and I think every parent does. I tell my kids, you got to don't make the mistakes I made. And my mistakes were, and this isn't really a mistake. Well, I guess it was. After my mother passed away when I was 13, I was an angry kid. I was self-destructive. I was all of those things. And going from a project type environment to a lily white middle class, upper working class neighborhood, completely different set of values, completely different set of ideals. And I was just an angry kid. School was the last thing on my mind. And, had it not been for, going to Catholic school up until eighth grade, I probably would have failed eighth grade, because eighth grade was a breeze, because it was basically the stuff that I had learned in school the year before. Ninth grade fell behind. Tenth grade fell behind until eventually I graduated with like a 1.7 grade point average, which I don't even know if you're allowed to graduate anymore with that low of a GPA. And, probably wouldn't have even gotten that had I not been a very good athlete. I played football and basketball and baseball and all of that stuff. Probably wouldn't have gotten that far. And certainly would not have been accepted to a large number of universities and colleges across the country. But I go back to thinking about that time frame where, telling my kids, don't make the mistakes I did. Don't screw up this chance of getting a good education, because a good education is going to get you a good job, right? We've heard that. Heard it time and time again. It's been the Democratic marching orders since the Clinton years and even before that we need to be investing heavily in education and make sure that kids get that leg up and all of that. And I agree with it. Understand, I'm not pushing back against the premise. I think we need to have a more educated society. All in favor of it. Want my kids to do really well. But the problem is, according to EPI, that you look at the overall workforce and you think about, my grandparents' generation. My grandfather did not finish the eighth grade. Yet, through his work, he was a truck driver. Through the work that he did, he was able to supply his family with a solidly working class, middle class type existence. They never wanted for anything. Now, granted, they didn't have big flashy cars, they didn't take huge vacations, but they did do. They were the middle class family of the 50s and 60s. I mean, it just was what it was. Go back to 1968, according to EPI. The overall workforce, about 37% of the workforce was like my grandfather, hadn't completed high school. Fast forward to today. Only 9% of the workforce in 2012 had not completed high school. 9%. And, we hear this, oh, it's a huge problem. All this dropout rate's enormous. Oh, it's the dropout rate's. Look, it's a problem. Absolutely. but it's not as bad as it used to be. Things are getting better. But, you know, when you start talking about like that, well, you're a heretic, you're wrong. No, it's not as bad as it used to be. People are graduating from high school. The problem is those folks who were the high school dropouts, were my grandfather, they're not making the wages they were. And the reality is today, our low-wage workforce is leaps and bounds more educated than they were in 1968 when they looked at the data. According to Larry Michaud and the people over at EPI, just looking at the minimum wage, which has gone down 23% from 1968 until 2013, the people in the workforce in 1968, you had 17% of the workforce college educated, compared to today where you have 46% of the workforce college educated. In 1968, you had 48% of the workforce with a high school diploma or a GED. Today, that number's almost 80%. So we have a much more educated workforce. So then why are the wages so lower? Why is it that my grandfather wouldn't be able to support his family? Why is that? And I go back to, you know, the very bit of reality. He had a union card in his pocket. It's that simple. It doesn't get any easier than that. That truck driving job was able to support a family. That's reality. And you look at the president's speech last week where he pointed out that women make up half our workforce. He said, but still they make 70 cents for every dollar a man earns. The president says that is wrong. And in 2014, it's an embarrassment. The president said a woman deserves equal pay for equal work. She deserves to have a baby without sacrificing her job. A mother deserves a day off to care for a sick child or a sick parent without running into hardship. The president said, and you know what? A father does too. And I agree. But here's the reality. And again, I go back to that contract. When you look at the gender gap, do you know where the gender gap really doesn't exist? The gender gap, you know, between what a woman and a man makes, that doesn't exist in the unionized world. The job is what the job is. And according to the National Women's Law Center, they point this out that the gender gap between what a unionized male worker earns and what a unionized female worker earns is just 9.4 cents, which means that women working full time make more than 90% of what men do, not the 77 cents. And what that equates to in real dollar terms is on average about $222 a week. What does that mean for a single mother trying to raise their kids when now the hours that they're spending away from their children actually pays? The reality to me is one of the reasons that you belong to a union is that you have this contract that makes that apparent. Because I think what happens, I think these employers get away with this. And I go back to when my wife was a manager of a billing office. She wasn't allowed to tell anybody what anybody made, and the workers weren't allowed to tell each other what they made. And if anyone did tell a coworker what they earned, and I'm sure some of you have had this situation where you work, the boss says, if you tell anybody what I'm paying you, you're fired. This is what happens. This is what happens when you don't have a union. This is what happens when you don't have a voice. Now, there's a piece of legislation that's been banging around for a couple of years, the Paycheck Fairness Act, which actually does add some fairness to people's paychecks, would make it illegal for someone to fire you for telling your coworkers what you earn, which I think would act as when you find out when that guy's making more than I am, and I'm making less than that guy over there or that, it begins to get people talking and thinking, hey, you know what? Over here. The sad thing is that, you know, if the share of people in the union back like when I started, which is like 21%, I think, back then, if it were back to where it was when I started, in the 20-21% range instead of 11%, what the reports say is the middle class worker in this country would probably take home somewhere around $1,500 more a year, whether they belong to a union or not. And this is the important thing to remember in this. You know, when union density in this country was 35%, that meant 35% of the jobs that were union had a 35% non-union side that had good wages, hours, and conditions, because those employers go, well, we don't want to join over there, so we're gonna be comparable. They were never the same. Unions always did a lot better, but when you had a big number, when you had 35%, that pulled everybody up. What's going on now is, since union workers aren't as plentiful, there aren't as many union jobs out there, we're seeing wages fall. In fact, wage growth right now in this country is at the slowest rate since it was in the 60s. Real wages have declined 7% since 2007. Since the beginning of the Bush recession, real wages have gone down. When you've got three people out there chasing every job opportunity, there's there's not going to happen. Now, if you go and you ask the boss for a raise, good luck, because there's the door. There's three people waiting to take your job. We've basically seen a lost decade. Wages have been flat, declining for the mass of the workforce. Now, on the flip side of this, wages have declined. Standard of living has declined. You know what's jumped? And we've talked about this before. Our productivity. People are working harder and longer and more productive and more efficient, and they're not benefiting. And what I see as really just destructive for our country is this accumulation, this mass accumulation of wealth that produced by all of us being consolidated in the hands of a very few. Politically, I see it dangerous by giving so much power to so few to be able to buy our elections. But more importantly for our economy, when you don't have people who can afford to purchase products, because like it or not, and I know some of my environmental friends say, well, we shouldn't be consuming so much, and I agree on a number of levels. But when you have a consumer-based economy, if you don't have consumers, if you don't have average everyday people with a little jingling in their pockets, you're going to have an economy that's stagnant. And in a world where we're the consumer of last resort, thanks to our trade policy, that doesn't bode well for the rest of the world, which I do then think ends up putting us in a position where these big multinationals see the writing on the wall, see an American consumer class who is broke, and then they abandon the jobs as well, which means you have a spiraling down that makes things even worse. Now, the president's talking about, you know, a minimum wage increase, I guess $10.10 for federal workers. You see all these people saying fast food workers should be paid $15 an hour, which I'm of that ilk. You see across the country this push, and Democrats, you know, are on the bandwagon. This is a winning issue for them. It's something that I think they should have been pushing, about 2 years ago. But even still, they're finally pushing this idea of we need to raise the minimum wage. So maybe, just maybe, we're going to see something positive come out of this. Maybe, just maybe, we're going to see an increase in wages and an increase in the ability of people to share in the economy, the ability of people to participate and to be able to support themselves. But we shall soon see. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Get up and take your money. All they want to do is get up and take your money. All they want to do is get up and take your money.
Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Assume that you ran a business that was found guilty of bribery, forgery, perjury, defrauding homeowners, fleecing investors, swindling consumers, cheating credit card holders, violating U.S. trade laws, and bilking American soldiers. Can you even imagine the punishment you'd get? How about zero? No jail time, not even a fine. Plus, you get to stay on as boss. You get to keep all the loot you gain from the crime spree, and you even get a $8.5 million pay raise. Of course, you and I would never get such outrageous, absurd, kid-glove pampering by legal authorities. But then, we're not the capo of J.P. Morgan Chase, America's biggest bank and a crime syndicate that apparently is too big to jail. Jamie Dimon is the slick CEO who has fostered a culture of thievery during his years as a top executive at J.P. Morgan, leading to that shameful litany of crime. Yet, federal prosecutors have bowed to the politically connected Wall Streeter, refusing to ruffle his feathers with even a single criminal charge. Meanwhile, one of the scams that Dimon directly supervised produced a $6 billion loss for shareholders in 2012. And his reign of mismanagement and illegalities cost the bank shareholders another $20 billion in federal fines last year, resulting in a 16% drop in profits. You might think the bank's board of directors would at least slap Jamie's wrist for the loss of those billions, but no. In January, they rewarded him, raising his pay by some 70% to a sweet $20 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, The New York Times noted that, to ordinary Americans, such a reward for poor performance, quote, may seem curious. Curious? Uh-uh. Try incomprehensible, insane, and immoral. Wall Street's haughty elites continue to demonstrate that they're common mobsters, only not so ethical.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I appreciate your emails. Appreciate you being here, listening to the program. I would love to hear from you again, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So I got this email today it was one of those things. Bob sent me an email saying, hey, you know, Rick, I thought you should see this. This is what the insane group, the Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania is pimping. Now again, I've asked the good folks at the Citizens Alliance who funds them. They tell me they don't have to tell me. Much like, you know, all of the right wing think tanks, they don't have to tell us. So I think we know. I think it's it's the Koch brothers. You know, it's the Americans for Prosperities, the Freedom Works, all of the wealth classes incestuously intertwined group of message peddlers. I think we get that. But the Citizens Alliance, which, you know, you go back in history, back, you know, 100 years, 120 years ago, the Citizens Alliances all across the country were set up by corporations, by the very wealthy. And it's one of those things, one of those moments how history repeats itself, how, you know, they're not even smart enough to rethink of a new name. Let's go back to what's tried and tested and true. Something 120 years old. Originally called the Modern Order of Bees. Then they went to Citizens Alliance because, you know, I guess it sounded better. They're pimping this idea that the agenda, that they're somehow the standard bearers of the GOP and that they're the ones who are going to homogenize. And look, you know, they're just trying to make money off of corporations. And you know, hey, I get it. You know, when you're part of the, you know, the oldest profession, you know, it is what it is. But, you know, they highlighted the agenda. And, you know, they point out that, look, they understand Republicans have total control of the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. They completely understand that. Steamroller power. And, in fact, they'll have control, in their view, for 12 of the next 20 years. They claim that they'll have two-thirds control of the House and Senate for an additional four of those. So they're saying for 16 of 20 years, they're going to control the House and the Senate. And they go through and talk about, you know, because this is what the gerrymandering has done. And this is what I love. I remember this because this will come around. The gerrymandering of this state, the creative penciling, the creative districting, the creative map writing, one that Magellan would have scratched his head at. That's what's given Republicans the power that they have. The creative districting has given them this power. Because remember, in this state, registration-wise, Democrats have about, I think, a 1.3 million registered voter advantage. Yet you had, I forget what the last election was, something like 500,000 or 600,000 more Democrats, or I think it was 1 million more Democrats actually voted. And somehow Democrats only ended up with 5 of the 13 House seats. Fairly interesting. But the Citizens Alliance goes into what they want, the wish list, what they're hoping for over this time. They want to eliminate the capital stock and franchise tax because business wants it. They want to cut taxes for corporations because, you know, as they say, it's, you know, as their email points out, it's the heaviest in the nation. Now, remember, we talked with Michael Wood from the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center. He said, yeah, we've got a high rate, but over 70% of the corporations don't pay it. So, again, it goes back to the bear in the woods or the tree falling in the woods or whatever. The same thing. If you've got the highest rate and nobody pays it, do you really have the highest rate? And the answer is no. The Citizens Alliance says they want workers' comp reform. Now, remember the last time they had workers' comp reform? Back in 96, where they completely, in my view, broke the compromise that was workman's comp, that I won't sue you for being injured if you don't deny my claim and pay for my health care. Well, they want to go back and undo that as well. And they definitely want to, and I've heard these comments numerous times, that they want to go to a test to make sure that, well, to make sure that you're not lying and that you were actually hurt on the job. And they're going to have, they want a very stringent test because there are so many people out there who are cheating. They're not. They also want meaningful unemployment compensation reform. Even more meaningful than the last set of Republican reforms, quote unquote reforms, that froze the maximum rate unemployed workers will get for the next decade. You mean the reforms that excluded and kicked people out of the program because they didn't have enough quarters in, but made wages and what used to be allowed, but not anymore? Mostly those people who work in construction. You mean more like that? You mean more like that that gave huge tax breaks to the employers who are already underfunding our unemployment compensation insurance? You mean reform like that? And the answer is yes. Eventually what they want it to be is like in North Carolina or Florida, where it's only a handful of weeks and it's paltry poverty wages, enough to make you, well, starve. And then take whatever's available. Because understand, and this is the important takeaway. When you talk about unemployment, for anybody who's been unemployed, they'll tell you this. As long as they had enough to survive on for the short term, it gave them a bit of breathing room. And I can talk about this myself. It gave a bit of breathing room to say, okay, I'm going to be a little bit choosy about the job that I take, because I want to make sure it's a good fit, not just for me, but also for the employer. They don't want somebody who's miserable there and is going to leave at the first opportunity. So you at the beginning, you're a little more judicious. I want to do this. Let's see what's out there. Let's see what if I can get something comparable to what I had, especially wage-wise. What the right wants, what the business community wants, is they want a desperate working class. They want people who are desperate enough to take whatever pops up. As soon as it pops up, you take whatever's out there. That's what they want. To them, that's reform. So that's on the list. They want the paycheck destruction so that you screw those public sector workers. They want the right to work for less stuff. They want to go after, and they want to end the ability of teachers to engage in strike activity, which they've already limited teachers to a whole bunch of really high hurdles before they can do that anyway. Also want to end collective bargaining for public workers. They want to throw in their term limits, because you know how much the right loves term limits. They want to screw workers out of their pensions, because they want pension reform. And they want to privatize the state wine and spirits shops. And this was my favorite on the list, they want to end gerrymandering. You know the gerrymandering that gave them the advantage for 16 of the next 20 years in the House and Senate, and according to them, are going to give them the governor's mansion for 12 of the next 20 years? The gerrymandering that gave them all that, they're against. I guess it just shows me how ludicrous the wealth class's mouthpieces are. And I guess that gerrymandering part, I guess that's one of those things to blind us, like term limits. They sound seductive. Oh, yeah, you know, we should get those bad people out of there. And I keep saying, folks, you've got the ultimate term limit. You've got the ultimate tool for term limits. Simply put, vote the bums out of office. It's that simple. It's that simple. And get good, honest, decent people to run for office. And we, the voting people, stop looking at it like we're examining the last meal we're going to eat. Examine people based on their policies, on what they're going to do, and stop with these nonsensical looking at all, caring about every skeleton in the closet. Look, I understand there's some things, but you know, if the guy jaywalked, I don't care. And maybe, you know, maybe we'll get decent people to run again, not just people who have positioned themselves to where they don't have any skeletons. I'd like somebody who has a couple of skeletons that they can come out about, and we don't care, but are good, honest, decent people, and their policy ideas are right. Just seems right to me. Anyway, going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk about what's going on in the world with our good friend Justin Duckham from Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We're in the process of making the demand and making it a strong demand on staples that they put postal employees, APW-represented postal employees, in these retail units.
American Postal Workers Union President Mark Demenstein. In a deal with the U.S. Postal Service, Staples has opened mail service centers in some of their stores. Demenstein says that postal employees are not being used to staff them, and that could put tens of thousands of good jobs at risk. It's a post office privatization thrust, he says, that goes deeper into the retail side than ever before. And he says Staples has had to pay millions of dollars in fines for wage theft of its workers, and Staples' wages are lower, with fewer benefits than postal workers get. Demenstein says that outsourcing mail service centers to Staples will hurt the Postal Service, and in coming weeks, the American Postal Workers Union will wage a strong campaign to stop postal work being outsourced to Staples.
the Staples is one of these classic corporate companies that has had to pay fines for wage theft of their low-wage employees. In 2010, they had to pay $42 million. They're in the process of lowering the hours of their employees to avoid any obligation under the Affordable Care Act. We think both the people of the United States are going to suffer behind this deal, and obviously a transfer of good-paying union jobs, living wage jobs, to low-wage, non-union, non-benefited, non-living wage jobs is of great concern to our union, and we think to the people of this country as well.
Nearly 1,500 United Auto Workers members from across the U.S., Canada, and Puerto Rico are in Washington, D.C. for the National Community Action Program Legislative Conference. The conference deals with UAW's legislative and political agenda for the coming year. UAW President Bob King will deliver the keynote speech. U.S. Labor Secretary Thomas Perez and House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi will participate as the union meets with members of Congress. UAW CAP delegates advocating for working families will be lobbying members of Congress during the conference. In Oregon, the Portland Association of Teachers is taking a strike vote on Wednesday. The union and the school district have a mediation session on Friday. Issues include salaries, early retirement incentives, and workload class size issues, among others. The teachers union says it doesn't want to strike, but they're, quote, resolved to do whatever it takes to halt the continued erosion of the teaching and learning conditions in our schools, end quote. All the workers at a Snarf's sandwich shop in Chicago are being rehired and will also get a month's pay. The workers were fired 3 days before Christmas. After they got together and mounted a campaign to get their jobs back with community support, they reached a settlement with Snarf's CEO, Jim Seidel. The workers are announcing the victory at a press conference in Chicago.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. A couple of emails during the break pointing out that, yes, the Broncos lost. I know. Thanks for that. I appreciate it. In fact, a ton of emails informing me that the Broncos lost, of which I am wearing my Broncos shirt today, just in spite, even though it was such a, the worst thrashing, I think, in Super Bowl history. And that's saying something when you look at the two thrashings the Broncos took back in the 80s. So there you go. Anyway, let's find out what's going on outside of football around the world. Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, great to be here. I was just as bummed. I'm a 49ers guy by heritage, and I wanted to see the Seahawks lose badly, and instead I was treated to a very disappointing night.
Yeah, they weren't in it from the opening kick. I don't even think the Broncos were in it at the coin toss.
You know, that's really what it seems like. I was with a bunch of New Mexicans who were supporting the, Broncos out of, geographic solidarity.
Sure.
And it was certainly a depressing night. My girlfriend was there, too. She got to see my mopiness, but she was really just watching it for the Full House reunion.
And for the really bad commercials. I got to say, this was probably one of the worst Super Bowls I've ever watched, and the commercials were equally horrible.
Oh, hands down. I mean, there wasn't really any that we're going to remember, next year.
I remember Bob Dylan.
Not for the right reason.
Yeah, I don't remember what he was hawking. I don't remember what it was he was. I honestly don't. I just remember Bob Dylan was there. I'm going, wow, I really thought that wasn't Bob Dylan's shtick, but there he is. And I still don't remember what he was selling.
Exactly. I mean, it was for Chrysler, but it's something that we're not really going to remember. Unlike the, Clint Eastwood commercial from 2 years ago that really played out the, renovation of Detroit and really left a lot of Americans with good, happy feelings. And, of course, we're still talking about that today. So had that not existed, I doubt this would have been such a major flop for, Mr. Dillon and, Chrysler. But lo and behold, there we go.
I hope their cars are better than their commercials.
I would hope so as well.
Yeah,
and I would also hope the cars are better than Dylan's last few albums.
I went there. Oh, wow, right there. I got to be honest, though. My wife goes, he's still alive?
I've seen him a few times live, and, I actually have to ask myself the same question every time he plays.
Yeah, well, there you go. Maybe there was an era that passed. But the big the big to-do, the America the Beautiful. Have you been getting anything about that today? I got a bunch of stuff last night, especially Twitter stuff that I saw and a bunch of email stuff. Have you been seeing anything on the America the Beautiful, the how dare we include anyone in the melting pot?
Absolutely, and of course probably the poster boy for the outrage for that is Alan West, the one-term congressman who had a brief media career with PJ Media and then sort of disappeared off the face of the planet, who said, this was sort of a slap in the face since it included, a bilingual aspect to it, and instead recommended a series of, shots of military service members enjoying Coca-Cola, which, of course, would have been disastrous, as Dave Weigel from Slate pointed out. Coke is not a purely American corporation. They're somebody who earnestly sells more of their stuff overseas than they do in our country.
Yeah, and in fact, they're all around the world. They're one of the largest consumers of water, especially in some of the third world countries, where they go in and suck up all the water supply so that they can get them to buy their products. And don't forget, Coke, one of the largest water companies in the world.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I saw it, and I turned to my wife. I go, the right wing is going to go nuts. The Islamophobes and all of the speak American people are going to go nuts.
Well, I mean, you really just have to, of course, they're going to go nuts, but you have to look at the audience that Coke is trying to reach, especially in its own country. If anything that 2012 really showed, it was that we are a shifting demographic. We are no longer sort of that, Anglo-Saxon America first type crowd. We are now a much more diverse nation, and we are probably the better for it.
Yeah. So you're not personally going to be boycotting Coke, right?
No, I love Coke. I mean, I you cannot pay me to drink Pepsi.
Oh, wow. See, now I'm a Pepsi guy, but just for one.
Really?
Just today, I bought a Coke today. Just today.
I think I may follow up on you with that and buy a Coke as well. I wasn't planning on it, but there we go.
It was just for today. I probably will never do it again, but just for today. Anyway, let's get into what's going on. I see Treasury Secretary Jack Lew saying we need money.
He did. He said he made some remarks today in regards to the debt ceiling, which is set to expire at the end of this week. And he noted, Congress, we really need to pass this now since we are in a different situation than we were last time this was agreed to. We are in a situation right now where the Treasury Department is not necessarily going to be able to pull strings like they did last time to keep the American economy afloat while Congress sort of plays the fiddle. This is a situation right now where, due to tax season, the U.S. is sending quite a bit of money out to individual Americans and therefore losing money overall. And, as a result, the Congress really needs to act before the end of the month in order to stave off major global economic catastrophe.
So when I know the big crisis is coming, what's the official date? I thought it was the end of February. This is kind of preparing for it. When's the official day when the next hostage situation goes underway? Because I've been waiting for it. I know the Republicans have been jonesing for their next fix of let's go to the cliff. When are we looking at that?
Well, the official terms of the last agreement was until February 7th, which is, of course, approaching. But last time around, we had a pretty good safety net in order to try to put off certain things for quite a while until we agreed to a much larger decision. And in this point in time, we do not have that luxury. We don't have more than 3 weeks to really get our act together. We have until February 28th, which is the deadline that Jack Lew laid out in order to get something passed. And his speech today was certainly intended to try to light a fire under lawmakers' butts.
So prediction time. I see maybe the 4th or 5th of March, them actually doing something.
that would not really be out of the realm of possibilities, especially considering this Congress. But on the bright side, at least, we do not necessarily see the, sort of weird demands that we've seen from Republicans so far. We certainly have a few insisting that they get something from it from, such luminaries as Paul Ryan and whatnot. But there really isn't that appetite to destroy the American economy heading into 2014, particularly when you take into account the PR hit that the Republicans took during the government shutdown.
Yeah, well, good. At least there's a little bit of return to something near sanity, I guess. But we shall see. Because I love a good crisis. And, you know, you need to have those every once in a while. It's just, you know, maybe not this time. I saw the report over the weekend. I guess the Keystone Pipeline, people are saying, okay, what's going on?
Here's the deal. McConnell today said that he is going to try to force a vote on it that would, in effect, go around the executive branch and put this directly on the president's desk ASAP for an up or down decision. The president could still veto it, but, of course, that would be pretty hard to do. It looks like there are 60 votes necessary to get it. Last time around, Democrats came in the force of 11, which came just four short votes away from the 60-vote deadline that they needed. And as a result, it nearly passed then, and it could pass now. This is, of course, pressure from the administration. We just saw a State Department report that said that if we were to move away from the traditional method of using, trains or other aspects to move this oil, we would save about 6 deaths per year, which, in human terms is something that's kind of hard to play down and may end up forcing the administration's hand. So it's not good news for the opponents of the pipeline.
No, I mean, I look at this, and it seems like all of the moneyed interests and even a good portion of our government interests are pushing towards it for a whole bunch of reasons. The one of them being, and as I read some of this State Department report, the jobs that they were claiming, because I've heard some wild numbers about job creation, but the State Department report isn't saying that it's an awful lot of jobs.
No, I mean, we've certainly seen the private industry reports showing a much greater increase. We've certainly seen Republicans playing up a lot of, sort of shaky numbers. But at the end of the day, this is something that has been ingrained in the American consciousness as a pretty easy step to create jobs. And as a result, we can see this being much more, desirous to Democrats than it has in the past.
Yeah, I mean, but I look at it and I go, you know, can you prove to me that the gas prices are going to go down and it's actually going to help us? Or is it just something that's going to be pumped through the country and right out the back door?
You know, that's a very good question. That's, of course, going to get different responses from different parties and those who are, of course, more interested in the environmental aspects of this, which could be, as they have repeatedly pointed out, disastrous. So we're just going to have to wait and see on that front. But, nevertheless, it does look a lot more appealing to Democrats than it did just a few short years ago.
Yeah. I would compromise. Build it to Chicago and then refine it there and mandate that the oil has to stay in the U.S.
There we go.
Yeah, there's an idea. I see the transportation secretary has announced today that they're going to be fiddling with our cars.
This is actually kind of an interesting announcement. Apparently, the DOT is going to be pursuing requirements for all new cars to have car-to-car communication within the short range, which they claim would actually cut down dramatically for accidents that could take place if people are allowed, if not impaired, to communicate with each other, or if cars can automatically communicate with, traffic lights or cars near them. And so this is being played as a public safety issue and is, a pretty interesting thing that's probably going to get more attention as time goes on. And, it's really right now in the groundworks.
Now, I've been telling my daughter that she's 5 years away from driving. And I've been telling her, we'll probably let you drive at 16 only because you probably won't have much of your lifetime where you'll be able to. I think at some point it's just going to be done. It's over. The Google car will come around. You'll say, hey, take me here, and the car will go by itself, and you will just be the passenger. The actual physical act of driving will be taken completely away. And I look at
it
this.
It is certainly coming off fleet, yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking at this as, just another step in it. But the other part of it and the part of me that goes, I've run a yellow light or two in my life. Is this just a cash cow now? Every time I exceed the speed limit and go through the beams of speed limit signs, are they just going to issue me a fine? Every time I go through a yellow light, will I have a present waiting for me at home? I think yes.
No, and that's likely going to be probably some of the opposition that we see. Of course, the federal government can't really argue that since, you're not supposed to be speeding in the first place, nor are you supposed to be passing through traffic lights. But nevertheless, there is certainly a... kind of a uniquely disturbing aspect that all of your minor traffic transgressions could end up being reported back to Big Brother. But that's something that we're just really going to have to wait and see on. And I don't see a situation where Congress would allow the technology to move that far.
No, not today. but you know, you go down the line, you know, you go through construction zones in Maryland, and they've set up cameras where they give out hundreds of tickets, you know, a day, you know, thousands even. And I'm not advocating for speeding, but when you're on the line of people you're following, or when you've been in the situation, you come to a yellow light and you've got two choices: you slam on the brakes and the guy behind you rear ends you, or you kind of ease through it.
That's very true.
Very, very true. Well, this is predictable, but it's the technology. Justin, always great talking with you.
Thank you.
Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Assume that you ran a business that was found guilty of bribery, forgery, perjury, defrauding homeowners, fleecing investors, swindling consumers, cheating credit card holders, violating U.S. trade laws, and bilking American soldiers. Can you even imagine the punishment you'd get? How about zero? No jail time, not even a fine. Plus, you get to stay on as boss. You get to keep all the loot you gain from the crime spree, and you even get an $8.5 million pay raise. Of course, you and I would never get such outrageous, absurd, kid-glove pampering by legal authorities. But then, we're not the capo of J.P. Morgan Chase, America's biggest bank and a crime syndicate that apparently is too big to jail. Jamie Dimon is the slick CEO who has fostered a culture of thievery during his years as a top executive at J.P. Morgan, leading to that shameful litany of crime. Yet, federal prosecutors have bowed to the politically connected Wall Streeter, refusing to ruffle his feathers with even a single criminal charge. Meanwhile, one of the scams that Dimon directly supervised produced a $6 billion loss for shareholders in 2012. And his reign of mismanagement and illegalities cost the bank's shareholders another $20 billion in federal fines last year, resulting in a 16% drop in profits. You might think the bank's board of directors would at least slap Jamie's wrist for the loss of those billions, but no. In January, they rewarded him, raising his pay by some 70% to a sweet $20 million. This is Jim Hightower saying, the New York Times noted that, to ordinary Americans, such a reward for a poor performance, quote, may seem curious. Curious? Uh-uh. Try incomprehensible, insane, and immoral. Wall Street's haughty elites continue to demonstrate that they're common mobsters, only not so ethical.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, just to follow up on a quick couple of things, you know, I look at the driving thing. And I got an email during the break. Bonnie says, yeah, agrees with me. The driving is going to be something of the past, especially in context of, you know, we were, this, it was the American open road, the freedom, you know, something that, that even she says she fears we're going to lose as technology takes over. And, you know, I've said it for a while, but, you know, this could be it. We're probably going to be the last generation that has full control of our cars. Is that a good thing, a bad thing? A societal discussion, to be sure. According to the article I read on the Department of, on the Secretary of Transportation's proposal, 4 out of 5 crashes, they claim, could be prevented with this kind of technology. Now, the question then becomes, you know, how much of that that communication is then trackable? You know, a lot of privacy questions then pop up. And, you know me, I'm very much a privacy person. I'm someone who believes that, you know, if you're going to put this technology in my car, I should at least know about it. I wonder how many people know who that if you have OnStar installed in your car, even if you don't activate it, it's still on your car and still can be activated even without your consent. Just a thought, you know, something to think about. But I did want to go hit back on the death of Philip Seymour Hoffman. Janet sent me another email pointing out some interesting heroin facts earlier in the program. And again, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. But I had said earlier that, you know, the number of, I feel for the families, his 3 children that are going to be left behind, and, you know, all of the other people who are suffering with this addiction. And according to the report that Janet sent me, a statement by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration spokesperson, a guy named Joseph Moses, he pointed out that heroin's a growing epidemic. It's back. And he says that first-time users are getting younger and younger than they were years ago. And it's not just New York City and the big cities anymore. It's in rural areas. It's in places like my backyard. Now, what the article said is U.S. heroin overdose deaths rose by 45%. From 2006 to 2010, and the amount of heroin being seized on the Mexican border has nearly quadrupled from 2008 until 2012. You may remember last July, the guy from Glee, accidental heroin overdose. And you know, the thing that gets me is you look at these numbers, and it's huge. And as Moses, the DEA spokesman, says, heroin's death. He says there's no such thing as a good batch of heroin as opposed to a tainted batch. And you look at the numbers, according to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, last September, they pointed out the number of Americans who had used heroin in the past year had risen from 373,000 in 2007 to almost 670,000 in 2012. And according to the National Institute of Drug Abuse, they say 4.2 million Americans have used heroin and at least once during their lifetime, and 23% of the individuals who have used it become addicted, become dependent. And you know, you look at this stuff, and what are we doing to stop it? What are we doing to help? Well, Drug Policy Alliance says that 115,000 people received methadone, 40,000 in New York. You got to wonder, numbers. Anyway, thanks for being here. Thanks for listening to the program. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath, but I sway, imperial, mysterious, and